Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. Today is a whooping and also amazing Friday. Today's my dad's birthday. So it's his third birthday in heaven. Okay. All right. So today is the 14th of November. And it is 2025. So we are talking about OCT today. So it's obsessive compulsive disorder. We're talking about it because, have you ever been sitting around and then, a thought just pops up in your mind? Like, a thought. But not a thought that, that is like, oh, I was thinking that maybe I should buy a house. Like, it's not that kind of thought, but it's a thought about something that's not actually pleasant. Not pleasant, not nice, not cute. And most of the time, it's not really the type of person that you are. So you might be like a nice person, a quiet person, a very soft-spoken person, a person that loves humanity. And then the thoughts that you get or the images that pop up, it's like a little video playing. Or it's like a little still image that flashes before you, right? And it's not you. It could be that you picture yourself smashing something, or you picture yourself beating up someone, or you picture yourself just destroying property, or you just picture yourself in a violent outburst. So, ladies and gentlemen, that's how I've been feeling lately. And I'm like, when is this? Why is this? Am I going crazy? Most probably yes. But at least you know how we navigate ourselves through life is by understanding what's wrong with us and by digging deeper into what we might think is wrong with us. So it's not diagnosing ourselves, but it is having an idea to see if we can rule something out and not rule something out. So the thing that came up is obsessive compulsive disorder. Now, when I visualized obsessive compulsive disorder, I visualized it in a sense of being obsessed with something. Being obsessed with something and wanting it in a particular way and it now becoming a disorder, right? That's how I pictured it. So I pictured a lady in a house with plastic wrap all over her things because she can't deal with dirt. And then she visualizes the dirt and the maggots and the what, and she's like, she keeps cleaning. Or somebody that is so obsessed with something that is clean, and they clean and they rearrange, you know, like I pictured it that way. I pictured somebody with a toothbrush, you know, that's just all the nooks and crevices there. They're cleaning them up with a toothbrush. Like, just imagine the tap that you are holding. And then you are just, so that's what I visualized. Kanti, no, not really. It is like that, but it can also be in different ways. And I'm like, oh, so maybe that's why I've fallen into the margin. I'm like, okay, I like this. I like where it's going here because we can learn here, because it's better to know than not to know. So obsessive compulsive disorder is a mental disorder in which an individual has intrusive thoughts. So intrusive thoughts are thoughts that pop up by themselves. They intrude your privacy. They just budge in. So if we are saying intrusive, intrusive thoughts, we could say budging in thoughts. They just pop up out of nowhere, unprovoked, anything. They just pop up. So these thoughts in themselves, right, are now intrusive thoughts and feels the need to perform certain behavior. So let's start over. Obsessive compulsive disorder is a mental disorder in which an individual has intrusive thoughts and feels the need to perform certain behavior repeatedly to relieve the distress caused by the obsession to the extent where it impairs general function. So sometimes, right, you might feel distressed because the place is dirty, and you might feel now to start cleaning it because you feel the place is dirty and it's giving you stress and it's giving you anxiety. And then that stress in itself might just become something else, right? Because now that's all you think about. That's all you want to do. That's all you are focusing on. And then there are symptoms. Feel the need to perform certain behaviors repeatedly. Have certain distressing thoughts repeatedly. So it happens a lot. It happens a lot. Because recently, my intrusive thought is me going to, you know, one of these escape rooms that you see on the internet and by socials and other countries except Namibia, where there's a gang of stuff. If for you that is out there, if you are a person that has, if you are like a doctor, or you are in the mental health practice, this is a brilliant business idea for you. You can have a smash room. Now, a smash room is a facility. It's a room, right, with broken stuff. And then somebody just gives you like a bat. And you just go to town on that place. You just break everything inside there. You break it. And it relieves a lot of stress. In other countries, they have it. But here, we don't have it. Here, it's called vandalism. If you do that to your boyfriend's things, it's vandalism. Mara, that's a brilliant idea. I think that that is something that you, I'm giving, don't say I never gave you anything. I'm giving you this business idea, which are you create this and then you market it, and you market it with a sense of stress relief. So you can go to all these junk places where they throw away things, and then you just put it there so that the people come and break them further. It doesn't have to be valuables or anything, and they just wear some safety gear when they go inside and safety goggles and all of that, and they really just go inside there and break some stuff, okay? Because I think sometimes we need that as an outlet. And I've been feeling like that lately. I've been feeling like I need to smash something. And I was researching on it, and that's why I wanted to talk about it. Cause, you know, I like to talk about my things in case somebody is also going through the same thing, so that we go through the thing together. It's no fun if I'm going through it alone, you know? So we talk about it and we get better. Get better with time. So intrusive thoughts. So intrusive thoughts are unwanted, involuntary thoughts, images or urges that pop into your mind unexpectedly and can be distressing. While they are common and most people experience them, they can become a problem when they are persistent, causing significant distress, anxiety, or shame. Now, where would the shame come from, right? The shame would come from the activity that you want to do. I'm not a person that vandalizes things. I don't break cups, and I don't break things. You know? I don't break things. I don't do any of that. So I think that the shame could be from what it is that I want, that my thoughts want me to do. And that's where the shame could most probably come from. But it also gives me a lot of stress because, I'm not violent. So why do I have violent thoughts? You know? Why do I have violent thoughts? Why do I feel the need to crush things and to destroy things? So that one is the one that also gives me a little bit of distress and anxiety, because I'm thinking of what about if I start wanting to beat up people, if I start wanting to hurt people and hurt animals and stuff like that. And it's really something that's worrying me, but don't worry about it. Your girl is going to therapy. It is what it is. We're going to therapy. Okay. So they do not reflect your true character or desires. And for many, they can be a symptom of mental health conditions like obsessive compulsive disorder, anxiety, or post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. Mm-hmm. So it could be like the intrusive thoughts could be an underlined condition, right? And it could be the cause of an underlined mental health condition like OCD or PTSD or CPTSD. So characteristics of intrusive thoughts are unwanted and unexpected. They appear without warning and are often the opposite of what you want to be thinking about. So you want to be thinking about chelete money guala guaps. And now you're thinking about smashing things. You're like, no, I don't want to go and smash things and vandalize houses and stuff like that. So why is this popping up? And then secondly, it could be disturbing content. The thoughts can be violent, sexual, blasphemous, or related to harm, self-doubt, or social taboos. So these intrusive thoughts, I think that that's why they are violating thoughts, because they come and they violate your thoughts, because on an ordinary day, you wouldn't be thinking about it. So maybe you are having violent thoughts, you are having sexual thoughts, you are having blasphemous thoughts, you are having taboo kind of thoughts, you're having self-doubt, or you are even having harmful thoughts. You understand? And this is, that's what makes it disturbing. And then thirdly, it's persistent. Unlike fleeting thoughts, intrusive thoughts can get stuck in your mind and repeat themselves even when you try to push them away. So it just keeps coming back. The image of you smashing things just keeps coming back. The image of you beating up somebody just keeps coming back. The images of blasphemous things, maybe you having coitus with a horse, just keeps coming up. Or maybe social taboos, you eating another human being, it just keeps coming up. Like, it just keeps coming up, and it's, you are not, you might even be a whole vegan, right? And you are having intrusive thoughts, and the thoughts are not depicting the person that you are. So now all of a sudden you're eating meat, and then on the worst part is that it's human meat, for example, and it's a thought that is just fleeting. It's not fleeting. It's not, it keeps coming back. It keeps coming back. It keeps coming back, right? And that is why we are talking about it, because they say that there's a cure. They say that it is there. It is, it's not normal, but it's a known thing. It happens, right? And the causes could be, number four, it is that it does cause distress. They can cause worry, anxiety, shame, or guilt, and may make it difficult to focus, right? So you are having anxiety, you're having shame, you're having guilt, because what if your thoughts are to kill animals? Like, you know, not kill animals like for eating or for consumption, but literally just for fun. So you might feel guilty, which I know you just go around slaughtering baboons or something. And that's bad, right? So it might make it also very difficult for you to focus if you have intrusive thoughts. So I'm just letting this simmer and marinate on this. So the next thing is what they are. Intrusive thoughts are a reflection of your truth. Wait a minute. No. What they are not. Hey, I didn't see that not there. I would have went on about, I mean, I'm not violent. You cannot say that this is the true me. No, I'm not violent. So what they are not, intrusive thoughts are not a reflection of your true self. Having an intrusive thought does not mean you are a bad person or that you secretly want to act on it. The distress they cause is a sign that you don't want them to happen. To you, you don't want them to happen. The fact that you are stressed about the intrusive thoughts that are popping up, right, is an indication that they are not who you are or who you represent yourself to be. So it is just intrusive. They are violating your thoughts. They are violating your mind, okay? Intrusive thoughts are not the same as intrusive thoughts. While both involve urges, intrusive thoughts are unwanted and distressing, whereas impulsive thoughts are often about immediate gratification. Okay? Are we getting that? So, ladies and gentlemen, today we're talking about intrusive thoughts, and we're going to listen to Lauren tell us about her intrusive thoughts, and then we'll come back to continue with our conversation. I think today we're only going to have one guest lecturer, and then we'll take it from there. So we as Eagle FM do not claim any ownership of the clip that we're about to play right now. This is strictly for illustration purposes. I thank you.
This elephant has incredible strength. She can uproot a tree with her trunk alone. Yet she will remain in captivity, held by only a light rope. Despite her ability to easily break away, she doesn't even try. Why? It starts when she's young. She's first tied down when she's small and not yet strong enough to break the rope. She will try at first, try as hard as she can to break free, and try and try, but eventually realize she can't. Suddenly, something attaches itself to her that is stronger than any rope or chain or fence. It's the belief that she can't break free. It's this belief that holds her back, despite her ability. I've had these same beliefs. You may have too. Beliefs that held me back. Beliefs that led me to feel unfulfilled in my work, to struggle in my relationships, and to live a life that was far from the one I'm living now. It was only when I became aware of my ropes and actively pulled against them that I found myself in a different reality. How do you break the ropes that tie you down? Don't believe everything you think. When I was 6 years old, I had a favorite babysitter, Amber. One morning, my mother told me we couldn't have her babysit because she didn't have enough money to pay her. So that afternoon, I started my first company. I gathered rocks from around the neighborhood, painted them with my art set, and went door to door selling them to our neighbors. That night, it was Amber and I on the couch together. When I was young, I was bold, outgoing, and fearless. I wore what I wanted, or didn't want to wear. Guided by my own voice that told me what would make me happy. I was also in love. His name was Fernando, and he was wonderful. As with everything else, I wasn't afraid to grab him with both hands. As I grew older, this picture started to fade. My exuberance was replaced with timidness, my leadership with conformity, my boldness with fear. I don't think any of us leave childhood without some ropes, despite our parents' best intentions. I grew up with a mother who was determined to give me the perfect life. Armed with love and good intentions, she did everything for me to help me be perfect. I'd pack a suitcase to go on a school trip, and she'd unpack it and repack it in a more perfect way. I'd be ready to turn in a school art project, and then she'd add her own brushstrokes to make it better. Later, she told me when my choice of boyfriend or apartment wasn't good enough. Although she just wanted what was best for me, I stopped knowing what was best for me. An unconscious rope was formed. I shouldn't trust my own voice and my own ability, and I feared not being perfect. Other ropes attached themselves too. I grew up in a family filled with yelling, loud voices, and strong opinions. To keep the peace, I learned to stay quiet, to not rock the boat, to become invisible. In school, I came to believe it's more important to blend in than stand out. And the pain of an early heartbreak led me to hold back in my relationships so I could avoid getting hurt. I'm not good enough. Don't speak up. Don't stand out. Fear failure. These were my ropes. This isn't just my story. Like the elephant, we all come to believe certain things in childhood that weren't true, or at least are no longer true, but we still live with them as if they are. If you've ever felt not good enough, alone, unwanted, unloved, invisible, powerless, like you don't belong, these are your ropes. If you've ever felt you can't trust yourself, trust others, speak up, stand out, ask for help, let others in, be accepted as you are, these are your ropes. These ropes hold us back. I found myself defaulting to others' opinions when I should have been trusting my own, staying quiet when it would have benefited me to speak up, and blending in when I would have been happier if I had the courage to stand out. This led me into a series of jobs that ranged from tolerable to miserable. In one, I hoped I'd get sick so I could stay home from work. It led me into a series of relationships in which I lacked confidence in myself, the other person, and the relationship. These never worked out. My beliefs affected the way I perceived the world, which changed how I acted, which led to a self-fulfilling prophecy. I felt small, and my world became smaller. What we believe has powerful effects. Decades of social psychology research backs this up. In a study performed at Dartmouth College, an ugly scar was placed on participants' faces with makeup. They were then sent into a room for a conversation and asked to report how people responded to them with this ugly scar. But here's the twist. Right before they left, the experimenter said, "Hold on a minute, we just want to touch up your scar a bit." Rather than touch it up, they removed it entirely. So unbeknownst to them, the participants went into their conversations looking completely normal. Despite this, they came back and reported how awkward their conversations were, how people avoided looking at their scar, had trouble making eye contact, and were tense and uncomfortable in the conversation. Their beliefs about their scar led them to see things that weren't really there and to make meaning of innocent behavior. What could have been a perfectly normal conversation instead became an awkward one. Their beliefs created their reality. Other studies show the same effect. Highlight an Asian woman's Asian identity before a math test, she'll perform better. Highlight her female identity, she'll perform worse. Lead a group of men to believe an athletic task is diagnostic of sports intelligence, white men perform better. Lead them to believe it's diagnostic of natural athletic ability, black men do. Give someone a white coat and tell them it's a doctor's lab coat, they'll perform better on an attention task than when told it's a painter's coat. In all of these cases, same people, same abilities, same tasks, different beliefs. And in each case, it was their belief that raised or lowered their performance. How you see yourself and your circumstances will affect what you see, how you act, and what occurs as a result. It's almost as if our beliefs place a virtual reality headset on us. A headset that allows us to see things that aren't really there and sends us into a false reality. We have these headsets even when they're miles from the truth. I remember hearing the top model, Cameron Russell, share how models, despite having the shiniest hair and the longest legs, are some of the most physically insecure people on the planet. An award-winning author, Lydia Yuknovich, share how she didn't follow up on literary representation she was offered early in her career. The reason, in her words, we don't always know how to hope or say yes or choose the big thing, even when it's right in front of us. It's the shame we carry, the shame of not believing we deserve it. Our headsets have us living into a false reality. They also cause us to bump into each other. Once I'd been dating someone for a few weeks. We'll call him Ben. We talked every day. Then he went on a work trip. For 4 days, silence. I didn't hear a word.
If you've reached that stage in life where you are tired of everything, where each day is just routine, dah, yammer me oh. No, seriously, I am genuinely sorry for you, because you clearly haven't been polanified. Like, boring day at the spun. Polanify your lunch hour with a delicious Polana curry. Chewing through yet another stale sandwich. Polanify your burger with a little mac and cheese. Tired of chewing the same shandy? Polanify your munchies with air-fried Polana pasta chips. Come on, life's too short for boring. Polanify every moment with Pasta Polana, a proud product of Namib Mills.
How would you interpret this? What's the first thought that pops in your head? My beliefs led me to wonder what I had done or said to make this once enthusiastic person change his mind about me. I shared his silence with friends. One, who admits she has trouble trusting people, was sure he was on this trip with another woman. Another, who admits he's afraid of rejection, guessed he was probably upset because I hadn't invited him as my date to an upcoming wedding. And a third, who has trouble with commitment, guessed he probably thought we were moving too fast and was taking some space. Each person saw the same situation through the lens of their own headset. Who was right? How should I respond? Each of these assumptions leads to a different response. Moving too fast? I should pull back. But if he's feeling rejected, this will just hurt him more. Feeling rejected, I should up my calls and invite him to the wedding. But if he thinks we're moving too fast, this will just push him away further. I was so confused. As I was ping-ponging around in my own headset, while briefly borrowing some of my friends' headsets, this relationship died a slow death. Are you ready for what was going on in Ben's headset? He'd been deeply hurt by a past relationship, was afraid of getting hurt again, and pulled away when his insecurities got the best of him. It was none of the things anyone had guessed. Sometimes our headsets get in the way of our relationships. It took me a long time to learn this. Just as our beliefs can hold us back, they can also propel us forward. Let's go back to the scar study for a moment. Imagine the opposite. Imagine the researchers place something on the participants' faces that leads them to believe they look beautiful and then remove it before they go into the social setting. Now, what do you think they believe about others' responses? How do you think they show up differently? What difference does it make if you believe you're ugly or gorgeous, good at math or terrible at it, good at sports or not? It seems a big one. I finally learned this lesson. My headset led me to law school. There, my long-held false beliefs were reinforced. Aim for perfection, follow the crowd, fear failure. This was a familiar path. Then one day, without thinking much about it, I signed up for a class outside the law school called Design Thinking Bootcamp, a class that promised to unleash my creative potential. I had to design innovative products and experiences, or more accurately, pull on almost every single one of my ropes. I had to trust my own voice, because when it comes to innovation, there is by definition no one to look to for the answers. I had to put myself out there, because innovation doesn't come from playing it safe. And perhaps most importantly, I had to be willing to fail, to be willing to not be perfect. The best designs came only after multiple failed attempts. If I wanted to get it right, I first had to be willing to get it wrong. I struggled in this class because all of the things that would help me succeed were the same things I believed for so many years I shouldn't do. I finally gave into their crazy approach, and the most amazing thing happened. I was free to go, play, try things, experiment, to live as I had before my ropes. I felt free in a way I hadn't since I was 6 years old. And I accomplished things I never would have imagined possible. I was astounded, proud, liberated, and confused. I wondered if the beliefs that held me back in this class were the same ones holding me back in other parts of my life. The seed had been planted. Maybe I shouldn't believe everything I think. Headset off. To take it off, I just had to realize I had it on. Ropes broken. New beliefs lead to new actions. In my first bold move since I was six, I turned down my offer to work at a law firm and placed myself in a different reality. I experimented with different jobs and took on various side projects, saying yes to ones I previously would have said no to due to lack of experience, trusting I could figure it out. I was still afraid of failure and taking wrong turns, and sometimes I did. I just no longer let this stop me. Then one day, I took on a 10-week part-time position coaching speakers. I fell in love with this work. We're talking Fernando-level love. No longer afraid to grab things with both hands, I went on to start my own company, helping leaders become more powerful speakers and to teach a communication class at Stanford. Particularly meaningful for me is that I now get to give others what I'd lost for so long, a more powerful voice. I broke other ropes too. When I was self-conscious and shy, I never could have imagined revealing my insecurities to you on a TED stage. That would have sounded more like a bad dream. Yet somehow, here I am. This process didn't happen overnight. Each new thought, each new action built on the one before it, until I found myself in a new reality. I still have ropes I'm working to break. My goal is fewer over time. To get there, I remind myself of the marshmallow challenge. Teams of four are given 20 sticks of spaghetti, a yard of string, a yard of tape, and a marshmallow. The winning team is the one that can build the tallest freestanding tower they can in 18 minutes. The marshmallow has to be on top. This challenge has been given all over the world to business school students, lawyers, CEOs, CTOs, engineers. Who do you think are among the top performers? Recent graduates of kindergarten. Here's why. The other groups will take what they think they know, what they think is the single right answer, and end up executing in the wrong direction. In contrast, kindergartners stay open to multiple possibilities. They test out different options. They gather information by experimenting until they find the best way forward. They have fun. What makes us so amazing as children is we live in a world before ropes, in a world before what's known, when there is what's possible, in a world before I can't, when there is how could I, in a world before falling and staying down, when we fall and get right back up again, undeterred. In a world in which nothing is holding us back from our full capacity. What the design class was for me, I hope this talk is for you. A seed that gets you to question what you've previously accepted as true. That makes you more aware of your ropes. That helps you see they were always yours to break. No matter who you are or where you are in this moment, there is the life that you can be living if you break your ropes. You get there one new thought at a time, one new action at a time, until one day you find yourself in a new reality. Thank you.
At the tone, please record your message. When you're finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
Hi, this is Anne. Give me a call back when you get a chance.
Sometimes, after leaving a message like that, I worry, maybe, I said,
your kids are ugly.
Are worse?
I want to mutilate your dog in front of your kids.
And it's okay to laugh. Laughing's good. I think, did I just say her kids are ugly? Please tell me I did not just say her kids are ugly. And besides, her kids are super cute. Why would I say they're ugly? But if I did say they're ugly, she's gonna hate me. You can't come back from telling someone their kids are ugly. She's never gonna want to talk to me again. Tell everyone I'm a horrible person. I'm gonna lose all my friends. I'm gonna lose everything that I love. I'm gonna die inside. And this repeats over and over and over in my mind. And it's not a fleeting thought that pops in and then pops out. It becomes all-consuming. My challenge is obsessive-compulsive disorder, OCD. In my fear textbook, normal, I am not alone. 8 to 9 million Americans, that's almost twice the population of Louisiana, suffer from OCD. Take a peek inside the minds of us with this disorder. It's hyperactive and supercharged, even when the brain is at rest. When I first saw the OCD brain scan, it was like looking into a beautiful piece of art that showed something in my soul that I knew but couldn't quite describe. I believe my OCD was triggered at an internship. There was a group of us, we all lived, worked, and hung out together. said something mildly negative on the phone about a peer. And next thing you know, no one would talk to me for a week. I experienced a temporary social death, just like in that scenario I gave earlier. And it was miserable. It was only a week, but it was a horrible, horrible week. I felt like I couldn't breathe. My chest was caving in. Knives felt like they were coming out. I was trying to type an email, and I couldn't type because my hands were so cold because the blood had rushed away from my extremities. And then for 3 years, I'd spent about 4 hours a day in this panic state. The first time it hit.
Efiloshisho utalikula ndulako na vewa yuka. Ekwashili palekolo maruendo paiwano kupitila mo NHB. Watupa teleko mesho kwashili palekolo fika mafio pedola emilio na omlongo danamibia. Moshi yoshe tukeshe kuyanja omakwafo unamiti enashane filoshisho lopa ulumo mumbu. Kwa voveli ponje yoshilongo, shijoshi topo rwasho ijo yetu, tashiningwa inapawe banando ishoshe layash. Opo umone ya kulolo polis maule omenute disyonailela, lishangifako nhp.com.na umanga ino ya moruendo. Ponjeo shilongo. E mangono malandula pano, odo dino kulandurwa. NHP, rooted in care for you.
Your health, your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
Hit. It was a few weeks after coming back from the internship. I sent an email to a friend, and his wife had just broken her arm. I very appropriately said, I'm sorry your wife broke her arm. But after hitting send, I wondered, did I write, I'm glad your wife broke her arm? And I had that same anxiety I had back in the internship until he replied. So this held me back professionally and in relationships. But really, the biggest way that it held me back was it kept me from enjoying the wonderful, beautiful life that I have, the wonderful friends, the wonderful family, the job that I very much enjoy. And OCD is sometimes called a time thief because it robs us of those precious moments of our lives and replaces them with fear and anxiety, and we can never get that back. Fortunately, I found a book that explained what I was going through was actually a disorder. And I was so relieved to learn this. That night I went home and journaled about this discovery. And I still remember the pile of tissues I had next to me as I realized that 4 hours of anxiety a day that made me think I was going crazy or had some massive character flaw because these thoughts popped into my head at all was actually a disorder. And that I wasn't alone in what I was going through. So you may be sitting here right now and thinking, wait, do I have OCD? And so we are gonna explore this a little bit. So I'm gonna do a little exercise with y'all. So the first thing I'd like for you to do is think of a silly word or phrase. And with this exercise here, we're trying to determine the difference between an OCD thought and just a regular distressing thought. So you got your silly word. Okay. So then now I'm going to go through a couple scenarios. If you've ever had a thought like this, even one time, I'm going to need you to clap your hands for me. Did I leave the stove on? All right. Pretty normal. If I jerk my hand right now, I would totally drive off this bridge. Especially on the I-10 bridge, right? So, what if I just picked up that knife and stabbed him? I am proud of Lafayette's honesty right now. Thank you for being in this with me. And now, let's get that silly word back into your head. What if And if you've ever had this thought, I want you to yell that silly word. What if I just yelled out in the middle of this presentation? Awesome. We've all been there. I'm glad I let y'all get that out a little bit. So the difference between these thoughts and your OCD thought is the OCD thought is sticky. It gets stuck to a distressing feeling, and that thought, with its distressing feeling, go on a seemingly endless loop inside your mind. To make this loop end, sufferers engage in compulsions. Compulsions temporarily break that cycle, but the obsession soon comes back, requiring more compulsions. And what's worse, the compulsions themselves are debilitating. Think of the germaphobe who washes her hands so many times she's late for work and arrives with raw skin. Or the person who's so afraid of driving their car off the bridge, they stop driving completely. For me, I avoided phones. But the thing is, avoidance doesn't work. In the words of psychologist Dr. Mike McDermott, we can't get rid of thoughts by trying to get rid of thoughts. To demonstrate, if I told you, do not think about a dog wearing glasses, chances are you're probably thinking about a dog wearing glasses. So if obsessions fail and compulsions fail, how do we treat OCD? Well, the answer is weirder than you think. Exposure and response prevention therapy are exposure therapy. By embracing the fear, we take away its power. We may still have that thought. Oh, this is a thought. We may still have the thought, but that associated distress detaches. The mental loop breaks. The breakthrough occurs. So let's take our germaphobe. She may put her hand in the toilet. So immediately, there's an overwhelming sense of anxiety. But eventually, she just gets bored. And that boredom is where that breakthrough is. So how then do I treat my fear of saying something so horrible I become a social outcast? Well, been in therapy since 2004 with Dr. Catherine Elliott, and she's wonderful. We've made great progress. We've done some of this exposure therapy in her office and said some of those very things I've been afraid of saying on voicemails, like, I hope your dog drops dead on your doorstep. And now I'm down from about 4 hours of anxiety a day to 4 hours a week. Whoa. Ah. Thanks. Thank you. But I want to take my therapy to the next level. And I'm doing that by standing before you today. Welcome. Every aspect of this process has been exposure therapy for me. To apply, I had to write down and share with other humans in writing and in recordings on video about my obsessions. I've come out to family and spoken openly with friends and then even neighbors and colleagues about this disorder. I even, with the receiver's permission, left some of these exposure messages, things I would endure hours of anxiety just at the thought of. I actually did, and people found it quite funny, apparently. Which is really pretty awesome when you have like your think of your worst fear in your the whole world, and then it's just kind of funny to people. That's great. And now I'm coming out to you, my larger community, about my disorder. And soon, once a video is uploaded, to the world. So I'm doing this talk to help myself. But I'm also doing it to help others who are suffering with OCD. Sufferers often endure alone, not knowing they have a common disorder. And since so many of the obsessions deal with moral matters, they may even think they're a bad person. But paradoxically, a high regard for social taboos actually feeds the disorder. If you're suffering from OCD, I want you to know these thoughts do not make you a bad person. There is treatment and it can be managed. And last, this talk is a challenge to you who do not have obsessive compulsive disorder. Now that you've had exposure, I hope your response is one of understanding and support. Seemed like the ending, right? But before I go, I have one more thing to do. I'm going to call my best friend.
This is Maria.
At the tone, please record your message. When you have finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
I ran over your cat on purpose. Thank you.
good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Today we're discussing OCD, right? Today we're talking about obsessive compulsive disorder, and we are talking about the challenges that come with it and what it is and how to maybe overcome it, right? And we spoke about, or she spoke about exposure therapy. That's when you expose yourself to the things that you are afraid of. But sometimes there's this general not knowing what is wrong, and you don't know what you're stressing about, and you don't know what you're anxious about, and that's why you need therapy, you need therapy, you need therapy, you need therapy. You need somebody to tell you what's wrong. You need somebody to identify what it is that you are obsessing about, or what is it that these intrusive thoughts are bringing. And that's why we encourage therapy. We're talking about it, we're talking about it, we're talking about it. So, when exactly should you seek help? If intrusive thoughts are persistent, frequent, or cause you significant distress, like, why am I thinking about that? Like, why is this popping up? If it's causing you stress, then see somebody about it. If they interfere with your day-to-day life, where now you're thinking about people and their germs. People and their germs touching you, and then it just, it riles you up completely, and now you don't want to go outside, and it's now interfering with your day-to-day life, because now you don't want to go outside because somebody's hands are dirty, and their hands are so dirty because they touched something that was dirty, and you just run with it, and you're wild with it, right? And then also, if they are associated with conditions like OCD, PTSD, anxiety, or depression, that's when you need to go and see someone. That's when you need to go and see a therapist or a psychiatrist, you know. I feel like there are certain things that, you would feel in yourself that this is for the big boys, so this is for the big league, right? And I feel like you can determine inside your body which one it needs. So now if you feel like you're a person that's gonna most probably need medication, then I wouldn't say go to a psychologist. I would say go to a psychiatrist, because then you'd just be wasting money, because the psychologist will still refer you to the psychiatrist, because the psychologist can't give you a prescription, right? So, but a psychiatrist gives you medication, and then you come right. So it's not everything that can be cured with talk therapy. Sometimes you need a little bit of assistance. You need a little push. You need a little nudge so that you can become better, so that you can heal. You can work towards it, and you can learn how to cope. And part of the coping mechanisms is addressing it or knowing what it is, right? Recognizing it. And then you label it so that you know what you are dealing with, right?
Bargain Hunters, you save has slashed prices on groceries, treats, fresh fruit, and veggies. 2 kilos real good frozen mixed chicken portions, just $89.99 Namibian dollars. 5 kilos champion spring maize meal, just $56.99 Namibian dollars. Pay just $19.99 for each of the following: 700 milliliter crystal gold tomato sauce, 1 liter clover full cream milk, and 200 grams of champion hunters poloni. Save big at You Save.
Alrighty, ladies and gentlemen, as we proceed with our evening tonight.
Hello, everyone. It's so great to see you all here. My name is Carly Coy. Like Whitney said, I'm a senior here at Olympia High School, and today I'll be talking about obsessive compulsive disorder. My title for the speech is called Holding the Mind Hostage, which may seem a little dramatic. I'm trying to make it a good title, you know. But I want to talk about my personal experience here with OCD, but also about on a general level so I can help educate you more about what OCD is. So first I'm going to start off by showing some of the more interesting ways, graphic t-shirt ways, that OCD is misrepresented on a daily basis. Some of my favorites is suffering from OCD, old, cranky, and dangerous. I almost want to get that for my grandpa. But this, I'm not sure if I'm, you know, fashionably inclined to wear this sort of shirt and broadcasting my mental illness, but I've started off showing this because I think it's sort of a lighthearted and funny way to show how OCD is regularly misrepresented. And one of the more laughable ways. I cannot imagine actually seeing someone, like, wearing these. To exemplify what I consider the absurdity of taking a medical condition and putting on a t-shirt, I've made my own designs for another healthcare condition or health condition called high blood pressure. And I got some pretty good t-shirts for you guys. High brain productivity, hungry, boisterous party guy. You know, you take what is a very serious condition, approximately 47% of U.S. adults suffer from high blood pressure, and putting it on a t-shirt and giving it a funny little slogan, it's funny, but you realize just how absurd these t-shirts really are. Now, this is not to say that all OCD merchandise is misrepresentative. There are actually some shirts often sold by advocacy groups, including the International Obsessive Compulsive Disorder Foundation, one of the premier advocacy groups for those with OCD. And these are the kind of t-shirts that are actually often moving to combat the silly slogans and the supposed jokes made about OCD on the other bad t-shirts. So this is the website for IOCDF. If you have time, I highly recommend checking it out. It's a fantastic organization. And these t-shirts show really just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the scope of these issues, as well as how deeply they impact our understanding of the mental illness. So a few notes before I start my speech is, as I delve into my topic today, I want to establish a few things. I'll be talking very frankly about OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. I'll be saying that a lot, OCD. And I will be talking about OCD specifically, even though mental illness misrepresentation is a very large and overarching issue. I'll be talking about OCD specifically as it is my primary mental health challenge, and I feel I can best advocate for this. I also will be talking about sensitive topics such as suicide and suicidal ideation. And if you have any sort of extreme discomfort during today's speech, I hope to sort of open new points of view for you. But if you feel the need, feel free to exit into the comments for the remainder of my speech. So, first, I'll be talking about the media and societal perception. I'm excited to show you quite a few examples of OCD in the media, but also specific even companies that capitalize on OCD. Then I'll be talking about the clinical definition. I know, sounds kind of boring, but with that explanation of the clinical definition, I'm hoping to break down some of the medical jargon so you all can better understand what obsessive compulsive disorder actually is. I'll then move on to talk about the harm and misrepresentation. Both for myself, I found that the ignorance around OCD has really impacted my journey in becoming better, but also on a societal level when it comes to medical professionals even misunderstanding. Finally, I'll talk about how can you help? What can you do to help spread awareness about what OCD actually is like, how it's different from those t-shirts I showed. So the first thing is media and societal perception. So I've got this fun page. You might not be able to see it, but it's the Wikipedia page, Fictional Characters with Obsessive Compulsive Disorder. And it's sort of hard to see, but there's some pretty popular characters on there. The first I'll be talking about today is Monica Geller from Friends, a very popular TV show. So throughout the show, there's no official diagnosis given about her as having OCD, only speculation and observation of repeated habits that viewers associate with OCD. As shared, this an opinion piece written by Meg Hansen in 2016 for the Augustine Review, it points out how the other characters never treat her obsessive-compulsive traits as abnormal. They either ignore it or accommodate her peculiarities by finding humor in them. The writer then eloquently poses the question, is it problematic to guise obsessive-compulsive tendencies as harmless personality quirks? Or does removing the disability label from the condition empower people to redefine OCD such that it functions in their favor? I think that's a question that's critical to consider when we examine media portrayals today. Monica's traits are shown, showcased as an overarching gag with positive effects on her life. Having 11 different types of towels, despite the financial strain, in season 4, episode 6, is a quirky joke, and her job as a chef is bolstered by her intense cleaning rituals. Another character similar to her is Spencer Reed from the TV show Criminal Minds. Many viewers consider his germophobia and technophobia to be OCD traits, although once again, I couldn't find a specific diagnosis shared on the show, nor any sort of treatment provided by a mental health professional. And once again, his work as a special supervisory agent, a detective, is bolstered by these quirks. Well, this is not to say that OCD can't have some positive effects in one's life or masquerade as a helpful tool. These characters' neuroses are simply punchlines. There were some characters on the list provided by Wikipedia with official diagnoses. One of them is Emma Pillsbury from the TV show Glee. In season 2, she is shown to receive helpful treatment from a mental health professional, which I think is very important in media representation. And her disorder does have significant consequences on the relations in her life. However, as she starts off as a side character, I feel that she and her struggles are still trivialized and really just used as a plot device. Benny with OCD may resonate with these characters, but my issue is with them is that they do not portray the true struggle or counter any common misconceptions. OCD is not easy or helpful or an adjective, and it is certainly not a funny little quirk. Representation of OCD's legitimate challenges as a true show of a marrying character is very rare. Scientific studies have noted this phenomenon as well, exemplifying how media portrayal affects individual and societal perceptions of the conditions. Here you can see companies that use OCD to advertise their cleaning. The fact, it's again, almost laughable, the fact that they're capitalizing on my severe mental illness to make people think they're better at cleaning. Believe me, my parents would be very happy if my OCD manifested in a cleaner room. So scientific studies have even also shown this. The symptoms, here's another example of celebrities that sort of trivialize OCD, unfortunately. Khloe Kardashian has what she calls Close-CD. And Close-CD is, of course, a play on her name, Khloe. And with that, she's made it into her own mini-reality TV show joke. And this idea, once again, that OCD is simply just a form of tidiness or cleanliness, I believe is highly concerning in how the media and the society understands OCD. There's also Donald Trump, that in a 1993 interview, the former president was said by Howard Stern to be very wealthy, and yet he's a prisoner of obsessive-compulsive disorder. Again, this is not to say that celebrities can't have obsessive-compulsive disorder or advocate for it, but specifically the fact that Donald Trump said that his OCD manifested in preferring to drink out of straws and liking to wash his hands a lot, it reinforces this idea that OCD is something that's small and trivial and nothing more than a slight inconvenience. there's actually been scientific commentary, like I stated earlier, that understands how audience members belonging to groups with mental illness, when they see themselves portrayed in media, it's often what they are understanding their own experience to be. So perceptions that this condition is not severe can contribute to trivialization by undermining efforts to describe the realities of OCD. And overall, I'll be including this presentation at the end, so you'll be able to go in and look more in-depth to the different quotes I include, but the scientific commentary on this phenomenon is legit, and they understand how the media perception is really harmful to the understanding of OCD. So the common themes that the most, I think, often a common symptom that is very much ignored by the media is intrusive thoughts. And with those often come stigmatized themes, including themes around harming others or causing responsibility for harm, for pedophilia OCD, sexuality OCD, and religion and morality. Because these kinds of themes are not funny, they don't have the same entertainment value of tidiness or cleanliness, the media ignores them, which only further contributes to the stigmatization of certain kinds and symptoms of OCD. So, now that I sort of explained and show some very, you know, stereotypical examples of OCD, what actually is it? So this is the full diagnostic criteria. This criteria is from the DSM-5, which is the Diagnostic Statistical Manual 5th edition, which is the premier book for diagnosing people with mental illness. But I'm not going to be reading that all for you today because it is a very thick book and that's a very long definition and I don't have the time. What I will be doing is I will be sort of pointing out specific parts of the definition that I think are relevant. So obsessions are recurrent and persistent thoughts, urges, or impulses. So it's not necessarily a physical addiction in the same way that drugs might be, but obsessions are persistent and they are intrusive and unwanted and cause marked anxiety or distress. Now, one thing about intrusive thoughts. Intrusive thoughts can actually be normal. Having the occasional disturbing, startling thought like, don't break your car, hit them, or jump off of that bridge. Again, it's normal for our brains to mess up a little once in a while, but with OCD, that is a constant and continuing sort of loop playing in one's head. Intrusive thoughts, like this drawing here on the left, can become extremely overwhelming, and that is when an OCD diagnosis is usually found within a person. Then there are often, like I mentioned, different sort of themes. So the four themes that I'll be talking about today briefly come from the New England OCD Institute. And it's usually contamination symptoms, which I find to be the most stereotyped. Then comes symmetry and arranging, you know, thinking about people lining up their pencils on a desk. Next comes doubt and harm, whether it be doubt about harming others, harming yourself, accidental harm, purposeful harm. And then finally, unacceptable and taboo thoughts, which connects to my earlier ideas about the stigmatized symptoms in the media. These different symptom groups are very relevant when considering the way that society looks at how OCD is understood. So, like I have this sort of graph here, contamination symptoms and symmetry and arranging are the ones that are most understood to exist, but the others are still equally prevalent. And I find for those with OCD is very common for obsessions and compulsions to change depending on situation, stress, etc. And so they can range anywhere on here. And so for those without main symptoms or only symptoms that manifest within contamination and symmetry, those that are shown in media and are more stereotyped rather than stigmatized, they can feel disconnected from a diagnosis and often may even face not getting one. I then want to talk about compulsions. So I've talked about obsessions as usually thoughts. Intrusive thoughts is sort of understood as the big part of obsessions. But there are compulsions, and these are repetitive behaviors or mental acts that the individual feels driven to perform in response to an obsession or according to rules that must be applied rigidly. So there's this one t-shirt I forgot to include, but it was like, rules for OCD club. Rule number one, you have OCD. Rule number two, there's two rules, so it's even. This idea of applied rigidly rules, again, is often stereotyped, but the diagnostic criteria includes compulsions that are repetitive and undesired. I didn't highlight the bottom, but it's sort of supposed to be understood in that it does not rationally fix or prevent the intrusive rumination. I've created my own definition with the help of my own therapist in sort of making this clinical definition more concise. And it reads, obsessive compulsive disorder is characterized as frequent and repetitive, irrational and intrusive thoughts, urges, or impulses that are not representative of one's true or core beliefs or intentions. This is the idea of ego dystonic thoughts, which I'll be talking more about later, that lead to distressing and time-consuming actions that are intended or presumed to relieve distress, but they do not actually rationally fix or prevent the intrusive rumination and or any other perceived possible outcomes. So I've highlighted what I believe some of the more important things. Basically, OCD is usually intrusive thoughts with things that people hate to experience, and then actions that are done to prevent the continuation of intrusive thoughts. So here are some examples of different sort of this graph. So often starts with an obsessive thought, moves into rumination, a compulsive action, and then temporarily relief until the cycle starts again. This model is based off of, again, the new England OCD Institute sort of steps and types of OCD. But once again, I'll mention that I'll be including a QR code where you can go and view these examples once again. Many of these examples are based off of personal experiences for myself, especially when COVID started. I was really worried that I was asymptomatic and nobody knew, and I felt I couldn't go anywhere or leave the house because what if I just didn't know, and what if I was going to kill somebody? And so those kind of thoughts is an example of how it can actually intrude into your everyday life. So one thing I want to include is sort of an interesting brief history. So OCD was originally sort of first written about in the 14th century. It was sort of understood as this idea of scrupulosity in the same way that, like, melancholy was traditionally called, what is depression was traditionally called melancholy. Scrupulosity was the term sort of used for OCD. Often the description of OCD surrounds things around moral and religious rituals and obsessions. And some supposed people that are apparently had OCD include Nikola Tesla, Charles Darwin, and Martin Luther. And so it wasn't until really the 19th century that OCD became recognized as a medical condition.
Great news. Imba just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of Imba? Get all exclusive features for just 36 Namibian dollars a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything Imba has to offer at an unbeatable price. Imba, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
Similar to how depression became realized to be a legitimate thing and not just, you know, a case of the blues. And it wasn't until about the 1980s that OCD advocacy and treatments really took off, especially with the development of SSRIs like Prozac, which are a kind of medication often used to help treat OCD. So I have explained what OCD isn't, or what it's commonly stereotyped as. I've explained what OCD is, and now I want to talk about the harm and misrepresentation. And this is where I'll be talking briefly about my own personal experience with OCD. So I was diagnosed at the age of 12, and my diagnosis, or the way I existed with OCD, was largely in the form of ruminating thoughts. So I didn't have the traditional hand washing or arranging things that, again, a lot of people associate with OCD. For me, it seemed like like I thought it was anxiety. The difference between anxiety and OCD, although OCD falls underneath an anxiety umbrella, is there's ruminations and compulsive actions or thoughts that come with it. So I would often feel mounting dread every morning when I went to middle school. And to attempt to calm myself down in what I realized now was an irrational compulsion, I would walk the hallways of my middle school counting my steps several times before class each morning. I'm sure, you know, great I got my steps in, I guess, but it was irrational. And I've created this diagram which sort of almost represents how I feel my brain is. There's an irrational part, the part that has the intrusive thoughts, the rational part which attempts to, you know, dissuade my ideas, and then the anxious, sad, and fatigued part that is, you know, tired of what is my malfunctioning brain. And I want to touch on this very important idea that intrusive thoughts are egodystonic. So I talked about, like, pedophilia OCD, harm OCD. OCD and its intrusive thoughts are different from, say, psychosis, because it's not at all representative of a true person's thoughts or state of mind. Psychosis is often a much more rare condition, but psychosis specifically often includes people who believe it's their reality. Yeah, intrusive thoughts try to convince people with OCD it's their reality, but it doesn't align with the person's true desires, feelings, or experiences. And this is where it gets the most difficult to deal with, because you're thinking thoughts and you think you're evil because you're thinking things that are not what you want to. You're thinking about harming children, which you would never do in your life. You're thinking about driving your car off a bridge when it's brand new and you just turned 16 and you don't want to do that. The misrepresentations that make OCD seem desired or useful or helpful or representative of a person's inherent beings or trait directly contradict the actual reality of OCD. And for myself, when I was diagnosed, I had a hard time reconciling the media representation and society's ignorance of OCD with my own experience in a way that it made it more difficult for me to open up and get help. You know, if my OCD was like Monica's, don't you think I'd get, you know, like better rent in New York City? If my OCD was like Spencer Reed's or Emma Pillsbury, wouldn't I be tidy or a really great, you know, music teacher? You know, why wasn't I understanding the reality? It's because of media like this. If my OCD was like obsessive Christmas disorder or obsessive coffee drinking or obsessive chocolate disorder, my life would be a lot different and honestly a lot easier. And so this is why misrepresentations have personally harmed myself, because it made me feel like my reality, what I was experiencing, was not the truth. It felt like what I had as OCD meant that I was untreatable because it wasn't what I thought it was. I want to give you some statistics. So OCD is very common. About 1 in 40 adults and 1 in 100 children have OCD. If this entire auditorium was filled to the brim, about 700 people, that means 18 adults in the room would have OCD. 50% of adult OCD cases are severe, which means approximately 1 in 80 adults can be inferred to have severe OCD. With the commonality of OCD as being severe or extreme, it means that OCD is common but also extremely difficult. I'll talk about that next. Because of often media misrepresentations, it takes about 17 years after the manifestation of symptoms to actually get a diagnosis, and often 11 years after meeting diagnostic criteria. I didn't write this down, but the most common age for an OCD diagnosis is age 19. But OCD often manifests around the time of puberty and in adolescence. In 1990, OCD was ranked the 10th leading cause of disability by the World Health Organization. It is no longer at that ranking, but the 6th leading cause of disabilities right now is anxiety disorders, an umbrella which OCD falls under. And finally, there's an estimated $8.4 billion economic loss each year from obsessive compulsive disorder here in the U.S. Finally, this is a hard topic, but OCD is extremely deadly. I've personally struggled with suicidal thoughts and ideation, and an average of 44% of those with OCD consider suicide, an average of 14% of those with OCD can attempt suicide, and those with OCD are 10 times likely as the general population to die by suicide. OCD, I want to emphasize once again, is not funny. It's not cleaning. It's not tidying. It's deadly, and it's a serious mental health issue that I think needs to stop being misrepresented and trivialized. Now, I have what you guys are going to love. It's a pop quiz. So, which do you think is more common here in the U.S., food allergies or OCD? This is over a lifetime prevalence in a clinical study. This might surprise you. It was a trick question because I'm awful. And they have the same prevalence. Over the lifetime, 2.5% of adults experience OCD, and in the general population, 2.5% of people have clinically measurable food allergies, such as peanuts, eggs, etc. Another question. Globally, this is on a larger scale, which is more common, green eyes or OCD? I have to say that I'm pretty lucky in that I have both green eyes and OCD. I'm a little genetic walking phenomenon. But once again, this is a trick question because I'm awful and I shouldn't become a teacher. 2% is the same. Worldwide, green eyes have a 2% rate of existence, and OCD is the same. I'm actually, like I said, a walking genetic phenomenon in that I meet the 0.04% of people who have both green eyes and obsessive compulsive disorder. Aren't I lucky? So this is, I want to talk about my own stigmatized thoughts, and this is where I'll be getting the most vulnerable today. But I read this story about a lady who, while under the influence of hard drugs, ripped out her own eyeballs, and it became a reoccurring, very intrusive and uncomfortable thought. I did not want to lose my gorgeous emerald eyes. This idea, those thoughts are terrifying for me to share because people will have misguided disgust and worry and concern for myself because of what is, again, ego-dystonic, not aligning with my true values. Stigmatized thoughts are probably the hardest part of having OCD and getting treated on a legitimate level. An example of this is writer Allison Livingstein for the IOCDF, IOCDF like website, was writing about her experience with postpartum OCD. As with postpartum anxiety and depression, OCD can manifest after the birth of a child. And after the birth of her first child, she started experiencing intrusive thoughts similar alongside with OCD. And when she first went to a medical health professional, she was diagnosed with postpartum depression and had CPS sent to her house because they were concerned about her intrusive thoughts. The medical professional did not take the time to find that her intrusive thoughts were not aligning with her real desires, or any sort of intentions at all, but rather unnecessary legal interventions were taken because they had not taken the time to look away from the stereotypes of cleanliness and understand that OCD manifests in thoughts that are not aligned with one's true self. Often those, although I'm not a mother, those who experience postpartum OCD are concerned that they might be experiencing postpartum psychosis, which is a serious condition in which the mother finds that there is an experience in their life that they truly believe is happening that can cause harm to those around them. Because intrusive thoughts often manifest in this idea of you might hurt the baby or those around you, they can be, because of, once again, the misrepresentations of OCD, they can be really scared that what they're experiencing is something that is not treatable and is seriously harmful to those around them. Allison Livingston was eventually correctly diagnosed with postpartum OCD, and she has since become an advocate for postpartum OCD because of her own experience with misdiagnosis. So, the term, I'm like so OCD. I remember one of the first times after I got diagnosed, I was 12, I was in the grocery store with my parents, and I walk up, and the lady's, you know, scanning our groceries, and she was like, oh, I have to put them in order. I'm like, so OCD. Are you, ma'am? OCD is a difference in brain function. It's shown on scans that it is very physically overreaction of the brain to, like, literally everything. It often, as you can see here, there's different levels of a functioning within the brain, and it has a higher metabolism in parts of the brain that are often part for planning, motivation, emotional control. And so OCD, again, not just funny quirk, it's an actual difference of the brain. And so when you say, like, I'm so OCD, first, if you are actually experiencing symptoms of what you think is OCD, I highly encourage you to reach out to a medical professional. But if you're not, you're completely misrepresenting what OCD is to the world around you because of your own misunderstanding. So one place that I found has actually been great in advocacy for OCD has been Instagram. As the world expands, as mental health progress is really growing, I found that a community on Instagram has really helped with advocacy. And you can see different posts I've included here that talk about and want to educate not only those with OCD, but the general public about the realities of OCD, like I'm doing here today. There's also the hashtag Real OCD campaign that's led by the International OCD Foundation. And this campaign is different online presentations led by people online and their job to explain the realities of OCD in a way that helps the world at large understand better what it's about. And one big thing about OCD is I haven't really talked about treatment. I mentioned how Prozac and SSRIs, a certain type of psychiatric medicine, is often used, but what is considered the gold standard for OCD is exposure and response prevention treatment. So CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, is often what is considered the most common for any sort of mental health treatment, but ERP is the most helpful in that it confronts and faces themes and triggers. So those with harm OCD might start carrying around a knife in their pocket in order to directly confront the fact that their thoughts about harming themselves or others are not their actual intention and that they're not a danger. Those with contamination fear might lick their unwashed hands. Yes, even during COVID, it may sound crazy, but for those seriously suffering with OCD, sometimes what is a perceived risk is so great that they need to face that risk in order to understand it's not the end of the world. So I've explained to you media OCD, you know, Monica. I've explained to you the clinical definition of OCD. You're welcome. I did not read the whole thing. And then finally, I talked about my own experience and the harms and statistics around OCD and its misrepresentation. So what can you do? Let me get to the point. What you can do, I find, is you can critically examine your media consumption. Watching what you and others say is really important. Go out of your way to not say, oh, I'm so OCD, is really helpful. Saying things like, oh, we're so a little OCD. It makes it normalized, trivialized, and again, plays on those stereotypes. Another thing that's really important to acknowledge is that marginalized groups, including people of color, are often ignored in medical care or underdiagnosed. And so advocating not only just for people in general for OCD, but specifically marginalized groups and breaking down barriers of systemic racism and such within the medical field so that we're better able to advocate for the illness.
Another thing that's really helpful is to support organizations. I really love those Instagram accounts I've listed there. I find they have a lot of, you know, they're pretty digestible content about how, what OCD is and how you can help those with OCD. And also, if you have the ability or even just the interest, go online monetarily or just even just check out different organizations dedicated to OCD, like the, like I've mentioned many times, the IOCDF. Or OCD UK is another great United Kingdom-based organization for OCD. But in general, when it comes to doing better with OCD, what I think is the most important thing is reaching out individually to ask those around you how best to support them. When I shared that I was doing my talk on OCD, I got a lot of people responding like, wow, I'm really glad you're talking about that. I have OCD too. Again, 1 in 100 kids have it. At a school of 2,000, at least 20 kids here might have OCD. And so encourage them to seek help from professionals, support them in getting the resources they need. Do not help reassure them with other compulsive behaviors. Often in the beginning of my journey, I found it difficult because I would be saying irrational things and my parents would be like, or my friends would be like, oh no, that's not true. Yes, it's not true, but what's especially helpful to say is help me cognitively realize that not only is it not true, it's not at all who I am. It's intrusive, it's irrational, it's ego dystonic. And that's my last point, understanding the fact that the way that people experience with OCD experience the world does not mean that they are harmed to themselves or others, except in extreme cases. And for the most part, the intrusive thoughts they are having are not aligning with their real desires and intentions. And that's really important to help reduce the stigmatization. I know I said this was the most important part, and I do think it is, but I think what really can be the best self-serving for yourself, for the world around you, is realize and take charge of the precedent that mental health is health. I suffered a lot with OCD, and I still have what I consider to be moderate to severe. But when taking those steps, having the courage to reach out to my school counselor and ask for professional help has completely changed who I am today. I've been able to learn metacognitive techniques that's helped me realize my thoughts are irrational. My thoughts are intrusive. I'm able to stand up here today and be vulnerable and talk about it because I reached out for help. Confront your own personal stigmas, not just about OCD, but mental health and illnesses in general. And also understand the way that you negatively perceive yourself and how that's impacting the world around you. If able, reach out to a professional. I am fully on team. Everyone would benefit from therapy. I really think, I'm hoping to go into the health field. I think Winnie mentioned earlier that I'm a pre-nursing student, but I really want to be an advocate for mental health support, especially in the fields of woman health, because overall, there is definitely, way too wide of a gap when it comes to helping those in the world around us in first helping ourselves be better mentally. So this is my final slide. I want to say thank you guys so much for listening. I've included a QR code here, which you can scan if you would like to be able to see all the resources. That diagram showing sort of a cycle and specific examples of OCD thoughts I think can be really valuable for many people who want to understand it. I've included like the Thurston County and National Crisis Line and of course Instagram accounts and organizations that I think are really valuable to support in helping further your understanding of OCD. I once again want to say thank you guys so much for listening and enjoy the rest of the TED Talks.
Hi everybody. My talk today is centered around the idea that living a life filled with love and trust is an active choice. Or probably more realistically, a series of relentless active choices, and how I learned this through my relationship with obsessive compulsive disorder. And even though I learned this through having a very specific mental illness, I am confident that all of you can tap into this understanding as well through your relationship with mental health or self-talk or even just navigating the everyday stressors that come from being a busy human in a busy world. I'll start with a little bit of background. Just as it sounds, OCD is comprised of obsessions, which are recurrent, unwanted, or intrusive thoughts, and compulsions, which are repetitive thought patterns or behaviors. And people with OCD often engage in compulsions in an attempt to make sure that obsessions don't actually happen. I was diagnosed with OCD around the age of 12. And at that time, it presented as a form called scrupulosity, which is centered around religion or morality. And even though I was not raised in a religious household, I was a compulsive prayer. I prayed for what I imagine now to be upwards of probably 4 hours a day. If I left anything out of a prayer or fumbled over any words, I went all the way back to the beginning and I started over. I prayed for every homeless person I saw and every person I had learned that was sick. I believed through an obsessive fear that if I didn't pray for these people, something bad would happen to them or myself. And eventually, this turned into a fear that if I didn't pray for people, it would be so selfish that God would forsake me. I could become possessed, and something bad could happen to myself or my family. So, no pressure. And this is how OCD works for a lot of people. It takes the one thing that you're most afraid of, the last thing on this planet that you would ever want to happen, and it convinces you that it's right around the corner. As I got older, OCD started to present in ways that most people are probably more familiar with. There were phases during my undergrad where I was washing my hands upwards of 50, 60 times a day. I had uncontrolled cases of trichotillomania and excoriation disorder, meaning that my scalp was covered in bald spots from hair I'd pulled out, and my arms were covered in scabs from picking at my skin. I was convinced that cold sores were transmissible in air and were far more contagious than COVID-19. I wish that was an exaggeration. I had also developed a debilitating fear surrounding STIs. And in retrospect, I can see that this fear was quite irrational. I believed that contracting an STI from a public restroom toilet seat was not a chance, but a certainty. I got to the point that I thought that even touching the door handle to get into the bathroom could result in contracting some type of infection. And so I avoided public restrooms by all means necessary. And by all means necessary, I mean that there was more than once that I peed my pants walking to my car from campus because I refused to use the bathroom. So probably a good indication that things were not going very well. The unfortunate times when using a public restroom were unavoidable would typically result in me calling my mom in a sheer panic just moments later. After 5 to 10 minutes on the phone of her trying to convince me that the S in STI actually stands for sexual and not toilet seat, we'd get off the phone. Unsatisfied with her logic, even though she is a nurse and that one was debatably common sense, I'd still make an appointment with the gynecologist. And just to really drive home the idea of how irrational OCD can be, I'll just point out that during this time, I was working on a bachelor's of science in chemistry with an emphasis in biology. So given the amount of biochemistry and biology classes I had taken, I had a pretty firm foundation for understanding the cellular world and how somebody might rationally contract a disease. But one of the hardest parts about living with OCD is rationally knowing how irrational your fears are, but the anxiety is so loud that you hand it the keys and you let it sit in the driver's seat. It was actually during a trip to the gynecologist where I realized that something really needed to change. As I was sitting there explaining to her how whichever bathroom I had used was resulting in my current demise, she stopped mid-exam, looked me dead in the eyes, and said, "Go home, Jade. You're at the wrong doctor. You need to see a psychologist." Mortified, I got off the table and I headed home. But not before she wrote me a prescription for Zoloft. And it was through the side effects of Zoloft that I learned, at least for myself, that the only thing worse than living with debilitating fear and anxiety was living in complete apathy. So, taking Zoloft was short-lived. I did, however, listen to her advice, and I looked up psychologists in my area that were taking my insurance and bringing on new OCD patients. And I found two options. I made an appointment with one of them, and by the end of our first appointment, he said, "I'm sorry, I can't take you on as a patient. I'm afraid I might make things worse." So, that relationship was also short-lived. The second psychologist never called me back. So, at that time, I was feeling pretty stuck. I didn't know where to turn. And before I continue, one thing I really want to make clear is that I support therapy. I support medication. I had a therapist in high school who completely changed my life. And for a lot of people and a lot of situations, these are wonderful interventions. But at this point in time, they had left me feeling worse, not better. But thankfully, this was right around the time that my intuition started to kick in. And it told me, try meditation. So, with nothing to lose, I started a regular daily practice. I started simply just about 5 minutes a day, working with a couple of different applications, and really focusing on breath awareness and mantras like, I am healthy, I am safe, I trust my body, I choose love. And let me tell you, fake it till you make it really describes the beginning of my meditation career. Neural pathways are like tunnels. And the more you use a specific pathway, the deeper you dig that tunnel, and consciousness flows that way more easily. Imagine how deep these tunnels can get when they have been obsessively and compulsively utilized for over a decade. But thankfully, something told me to stick with meditation. And over time, what I can only describe as mental health miracles began to take place. I was able to sit and focus on my breath for minutes at a time without intrusive thoughts coming in. And inevitably, when they came, I was able to label them as such. And it made it a lot easier to let them go. My mantras also started to feel more natural. I started to think, yeah, I could probably trust my body. I'm most likely not going to die. We'll call it 60-40. And those might sound like bad odds right now, but for someone who thought she was actively dying every day, those are pretty good odds. And it didn't stop there. What a lot of people don't know is that meditation is far more about the work that comes once off the cushion. How do you take these newfound insights and apply them to your day-to-day life? Meditation gave me a challenge. It said, choose love and trust in every moment of every day. And being competitive in nature, I accepted this challenge. And thus ensued one of the most anxious periods of my entire life as I underwent what some might call self-induced exposure therapy. If I needed to use the public restroom, I used the public restroom. And the whole time I mantraed, I am safe, I am healthy, I trust my body, I choose love. If I needed to get into class, I touched the door handle and I let myself in. And over time, what I came to realize was that none of these horrible things that I obsessed might happen because of these actions actually happened. I realized the fear, the anxiety, the OCD itself was the things that were holding me back from truly living my life, not these things that I irrationally feared. And this brought me to the understanding that I was not OCD. I was a person whom OCD tried to control. And so I became adamant about separating myself from OCD. And in my experience, when you decide that you are ready to learn something, instead of just being handed that thing on a silver platter, you are given many, many, and sometimes many more opportunities to develop mastery. Despite my progress during this time frame I've been talking about, I probably moved close to 12 times because my fear of public restrooms translated to a fear of the restrooms in my house because I always lived with roommates. So I was constantly moving, trying to find a cleaner bathroom, a cleaner kitchen, a place where I felt more safe and at home. And I truly believe that once I obtained this environment, the remaining clutches of OCD would let go. And I thought I had this piece of the puzzle in place when I got into graduate school. I was admitted to Texas Tech, and with the help of my generous father, we bought a 3-bedroom, 3-bathroom condo. And finally, I was going to have my own bathroom. I was going to be in charge. It was going to be perfect. And a month before moving, my advisor messaged me, told me he was moving institutions and he was not taking graduate students with him. Thankfully, however, I was admitted here to Montana State University just a few days later. But as I'm sure many of you are intimately aware, the housing market in Bozeman, Montana is quite different than the housing market in Lubbock, Texas. So we did not buy another house at that time. Instead, I moved in with 3 23-year-old men. A small-scale frat house. And as you can imagine, my best attempts of talking one of them out of the master bedroom proved unsuccessful. So sharing a bathroom with the other two was my option. And as I started to feel the anxiety rising up, I realized that I had a choice. Whether I thought I was going to feel scared and uncomfortable or I was going to feel safe and at peace in my environment, I was right. The mindset I was to choose would shape the lens through which I looked at my reality. You see, love is a choice. Trust is a choice. And giving into fear, that one's also a choice. And I made a choice in that moment that the love and the trust that I had been working so hard for years to cultivate were truly going to mean something. And it is with the deepest sense of gratitude that I am able to stand in front of all of you today and say that I have been living at this small-scale frat house for 7 months, and for the first time in my adult life, I feel safe and at peace and comfortable in my home. I realized that obtaining my own bathroom, obtaining any physical thing, would never have been the solution. I needed to attain the mindset that set me free. And these days, I don't think twice about using a public restroom. Usually. And my spiritual practice is healthy and it's built on love. Of course, I still have my moments of fear and anxiety, but I know it's my choice whether or not they persist. William James, father of American psychology, once said, "The greatest weapon against stress is our ability to choose one thought over another." We all have the capacity to choose which thoughts we give our power to in every moment. These choices shape the way we view our reality, and therefore, they shape the way we live our lives. And so I challenge all of you, go out and choose love and choose trust, especially in the face of fear and doubt, because fear and doubt lose their power in the presence of love and trust. Thank you.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is our last conversation that we're going to be listening to, and then we dive.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for coming this early to see a psychiatrist. I'm sure now you can proudly say that you have seen one. I'm sure all of you will agree that relationships are important. They are helpful for our well-being and our joy. And we learned this in a difficult way during the pandemic. Every relationship is very, very important, whether it's with a family, with our friends or our lover. And for those of you who have been in love will know that it's an indescribable, unparalleled experience. When you are in love, you are lost in the thoughts of your lover, even obsessed about them to some extent. And that's okay. But what is also very common is to have doubt, insecurity and uncertainty. I think to some extent that is required, so that you can be on your toes, be attentive to your lover, and also invest in the relationship, which is usually very dynamic in nature and requires your consistent input. I want you to imagine this for a minute. Imagine you are now in love with somebody. You are with somebody you always wanted to be with, but there is a nagging thoughts in your head, constantly doubting about your feelings towards your partner, your partner's feelings towards you, and the rightness of the relationship. Even obsessing on whether you are stuck in the wrong relationship. Constantly questioning whether she is the right one for me, whether I'm stuck in the wrong relationship, whether she loves me enough, do we look good together? You start obsessing on the various aspects of your partner, her appearance, her features, her manner, constantly evaluating whether the way she talks to you means that she loves you or not loves you. When she looks away, does it mean that she's not interested in you? Imagine being plagued by these thoughts and consumed by them day in and day out for hours on end each day. Imagine being stuck in a relentless cycle of doubt and uncertainty even when things are going all right. Even when you have been assured that things are going well and that you are in love and the partner loves you. That is the reality of those we see with people with relationship obsessive compulsive disorder. Now you would start to think that does such a disorder at all exist? Or is this absolutely a new condition? You might have heard of people being obsessed in relationships, even like it to some extent when your partner is obsessing about you. In 25 years of my clinical practice, I have seen a wide range of emotional and psychological problems. Many of them stem from relationship issues. And I can tell you with confidence that most of the relationship issues are directly related to communication problems. So that means that the communication makes it the foremost pillar of relationship, with trust, respect, and love being the other three pillars. So, for example, if you have a very open, honest, and a very consistent communication, then it makes for a very robust and committed relationship. Conversely, if you have an inconsistent communication with your partner, then that means you're going to have a confused and conflicted relationship. What we also see in the clinical practice is those with obsessive thinking and obsessive spectrum. And I think that becomes quite difficult to manage, because people who present with obsession, which is over and above and excessive, have got so frustrated that they are not able to contain their thoughts, and they present with an impatience to be resolved immediately. When we look at the disorders, we'd like to look at obsessive compulsive spectrum. And I call it spectrum because they're a group of disorders brought together where they have common features like preoccupation, obsessions, and intrusive thinking. And there are other disorders in the spectrum apart from OCD, which includes body dysmorphia, which you might know of, hypochondriasis, and impulse control disorders. But looking at the spectrum makes it easy, but looking at problems as a continuum makes it even easier, because nothing exists on its own. They always exist on a continuum. For example, with obsessive spectrum, you look at obsession on one end and compulsion or obsessive compulsive disorder on the other end. So looking at obsession, why does it have such negative connotations? We all have experienced obsessive thinking and obsessions in our lifetime. Take for example, we have been obsessed with our work, our routine, our things, and our relationships. We are obsessed about everything. You'd agree that we are obsessed with ourselves, driven by social media related perfectionism and narcissism. I think that we are in a pandemic of obsessive and overthinking. Why? Because we are bombarded with information. We are constantly engaged with everything and everyone at all given times. So that is going to contribute to a continuous flow of thought, which is never going to stop. And that is something that we see all the time in practice, where we are in a hyper alert and hyper engaged, always thinking mode. Obsession has got negative connotations because it is associated with compulsions and unhealthy fixations. But it is a normal human experience. It becomes a problem when it becomes excessive. The way to differentiate between healthy and unhealthy obsession is this. The unhealthy obsessions are intrusive, they're distressing, and they're difficult to get rid of. And that's where OCD comes in. OCD entails an unhealthy obsessions. Remember, we all might have obsessive thinking, but not all of them will have obsessive compulsive disorder. So what is it? Obsessive compulsive disorder is an anxiety disorder, a mental health condition, which is seen in about 2% of the population. So the good news is that 98% of people are not going to have OCD. So that is good. But we all have obsessive thinking. In obsessive compulsive disorder or OCD, you have repetitive and persistent obsessions and compulsions. And obsessions or unhealthy obsessions are what? They are repetitive by nature. They are unwanted and intrusive. They are distressing because you can't get rid of them. The individual will try and make every effort to sustain and suppress them. And they find it difficult. Compulsions are act to contain the obsessive thinking and so on. So repetitive behavior to contain obsessive disorder is what OCD is. When the obsessive thinking is targeted more towards relationships, then it becomes obsessive compulsive disorder, relationship obsessive compulsive disorder. Eminent psychologists like Daron Darby defined this as a distinctive problem within the spectrum itself, and they stated that it is more specifically related to relationship obsessive, and that it is part of the OCD disorder itself. They stated that it's not a couple problem, it's an individual problem with ramifications for relationships. So relationship OCD has profound ramifications for individuals and for partners. They defined, and we see in clinical practice, that relationship obsessive compulsive disorder can be of two types. One can be relationship centric, where the doubt is constantly hovering on the relationship itself, and then the other one is partner centric, where the doubts and obsessions are really hovering around the partner's features, appearance, and behavior. What we need to understand is that ROCD also runs on a continuum, to know that having doubts and obsessions doesn't make it relationship obsessive compulsive disorder. but it is the disproportionate and distressing nature of the symptoms which make it problematic. So what are the causes? The causes of relationship obsessive compulsive disorder and OCD are multiple in nature. We know that they could be biological, psychological, or socio-environmental in nature. Biological causes are well established. OCD are heritable. They run in families. We know that there's chemical imbalance with abnormalities in serotonin level, which contributes to OCD and anxiety symptoms. And this is also proven by the fact that antidepressants are effective in OCD because they increase the serotonin levels. Then we have psychological theories, which include cognitive theory, which suggests that obsessive compulsive behaviors are learned behavior. So, for example, fear and anxiety are acquired from operant and classical principles. They suggest that when a normal or neutral thought can start to elicit fear when they're repeatedly paired with events that cause distress. So fear and anxiety is learned, and then avoidance behavior is developed or adapted so that you can manage the anxiety. That is important when we do cognitive therapy, where it suggests that we can, what we learn can be unlearned. Psychodynamic theory gives more interesting perspective on OCD symptoms. They suggest that OCD symptoms develop as a result, as a way of managing the anxiety which emanates from unconscious conflict and unresolved psychological issues. They go on to emphasize the importance of early childhood experiences and our formative relationships in shaping our attachment style and also shaping our personality and lifelong social interactions. So, for example, if you had traumatic childhood experiences, then you're going to develop unhealthy attachment style, which in younger years will present as separation anxiety, being clingy, and so on. In later life, it will present as an obsessive tendencies in the relationship, which, as you know, will be quite damaging.
Goeie nuus, Imba het nou nog beter geword. Ons het splinter nuwe funksies bygevoeg om jou ervaring vinniger, beter en kragtiger te maak as ooit tevore. Is jy gereed om die volle potensiaal van Imba te geniet? Kry alle eksklusiewe funksies vir slegs $36 per maand. Of spaar selfs meer met ons spesiale intekenplanne. 5% afslag vir 'n 3 maande intekening, 10% afslag vir 'n 6 maande intekening en 25% afslag vir 'n 12 maande intekening. Kies die beste plan vir jou werk en geniet al die voordele wat Imba bied teen 'n onverbeterlike prys. Imba, waar die wêreld saamkom, laai dit af en teken vandag aan.
So, formative experiences are quite important in the way we interact, relate, and react in our life. Our earlier years guide how we deal with our relationship and people that we deal with in later lives. Understanding psychodynamic and cognitive theory help us to devise treatment plan for individuals. Then we have social learning theory, which suggests that we learn by observation. And you'll agree that the environmental influences around us influence our behavior a lot. Social media, for example, is driving the sense of perfectionism and narcissism and obsessed love with ourselves and obsession in having a perfect appearance or a perfect relationship. Indian cinema produces 1,000 movies each year. And I would be surprised that if none of us are influenced heavily by it. Most of the Indian cinema presents relationship in a very delicate and sensitive manner. But many other present and romanticize unhealthy behavior, such as persistent pursuit of your loved ones, dominance and control. And the pursuit typically shown in the cinema are nagging, harassment, bullying, even stalking until your love interest accepts and agrees. It is somewhat seems to have been completely normalized, this behavior, and is also completely accepted by the female protagonist who would participate in song and dance soon after an incident of harassment and so on. Relationship portrayals in cinema is such that it's okay to do everything in your power to pursue your love and sustain your love. And presentation of toxic masculinity in recent movies is furthering the obsessive tendencies, setting unrealistic expectations, and also having a distorted perception of love, of dominance, and of control. So that is not going to do with most well in most of our relationships. We might not know the exact causes of obsessive compulsive disorder or ROCD, Here is try to explain that. But we do know that they cause significant amount of problems in relationship. So what are the problems? Data very clearly suggests that 85% of people with OCD present or report moderate to severe impairment on their life. Nearly 75% of people report having developed other anxiety disorders other than OCD. 9 out of 10 people who have OCD suffer from other mental health disorders in their lifetime. And this is important. About 56% of people with OCD will go on to have or get diagnosed with ADHD. So this is important. We must need to know what it causes. But OCD causes a very indirect impact on relationships. For example, because of the obsessions and compulsions, one will be restricted by the obsessions, but also become restrictive, preventing the partners from doing things. So it's a very indirect impact. But in ROCD, the impact is very direct because the symptoms are focused on the relationship, and which contributes to conflict and breakdown of mental health, but also breakdown of relationships. On partners, the impact and the negative effect is unspeakable. And they will be rather confused, anxious, and unsure as to what's happening when they think things are going all right. So how do we treat it? Well, for a complex disorder like obsessive compulsive and ROCD, we need to look at multi-pronged approach, and they should include medical, psychological, and social skills interventions. Medicinal intervention, I think, is the foremost in OCD, because patient presenting have significant amount of symptoms, and we need to be able to reduce the anxiety and obsessive compulsive symptoms in order to engage them with rational discussions, in order to engage them with psychological interventions. Medicines like antidepressants are not addictive, like hypnotics and tranquilizers. So there is a lot of misconceptions around that. Medicines heavily influence people's engagement in therapy. From psychological perspective, exposure and response prevention is a very validated approach. It's a type of CBT where you educate the individual about the symptoms itself. You help them identify the triggers, and then you help them learn to resist the compulsions in a way that they manage to contain their anxiety, but also regain control of their emotions and senses. Once the person is exposed and confident with managing the compulsions, next, you expose them to very triggers that trigger obsessions and compulsions, and then you help them to sustain or resist the compulsions in a systematic manner. So over time, you expose them to higher hierarchy of anxiety-provoking situations, and they become more and more confident in resisting the compulsions. This is a relearning process or a cognitive therapy where the brain is rewired and the person is taught that it's okay not to do things or act which you think is prevented by doing certain actions. It's okay that what you fear is not going to happen. We need to experience it in order to know about it. Just simply telling it doesn't work. So ERP is very validated approach to ROCD and OCD. Social skills training is very, very important in those with OCD, because you are helping them to develop communication, adaptive, consistent, and timely communication makes for a committed and clear relationship where expectations are clearly understood and where concerns and anxieties and insecurities are addressed in a timely manner. So social skills training play an equal part. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that a combination of medicine, psychological therapy, and social interventions is more effective than either one alone. And of course, you might look at doing couple therapy sessions to help them have better interpersonal interactions. For someone who has a partner with obsessive tendencies, I would suggest to look for signs of obsessive features in their personality or obsessive tendencies in the relationship itself. And here you need to look for the red flags. And what are the red flags? Well, the red flags simply means that look for certain behaviors in your partner which could include consistent need for contacting. For example, somebody is texting, messaging you all the time, wanting you to call back, following you, even turning up on you all the time, you know, making you very claustrophobic in the relationship. Look for features of manipulation. Look for features of compulsion. And look for features of possessiveness. look if the partner is ignoring their personal self-care over the relationship and also ignoring boundaries. So you need to look at the red flags, identify early features of obsessive tendencies and speak up about it. And if it's difficult, seek help. We have psychologists and psychiatrists everywhere to take you through your confusion and your frustration. Finally, one of the things I need to say is that if you have obsessive tendencies or partner, then it is important to educate yourself, which would be a good way to start off by understanding the problem, by understanding what causes it, what are the coping mechanisms, and that will equip you to get less frustrated and support someone who might have obsessive tendencies in relationship. Be patient, be compassionate. Every little help can take the person in the right direction or in the wrong direction. When we are in relationship, we need to see that work to together and help each other. I want to finish off by saying that ROCD and OCD are complex disorders and they need an early intervention. Therefore, the recovery is better. Otherwise, the impact is very, very damaging. It is very, very important to seek help, which I think is a sign of strength, not weakness. More importantly, accepting your vulnerabilities and accepting your problems is rather courageous, and I feel it's pure courage in action. Finally, for those of you listening, if you have known anybody with obsessive tendencies, this talk is not meant to agitate anybody, but to educate and raise awareness so that you take preemptive actions and you support your partner and help them to speak up or seek help in an appropriate and early manner. Thank you so much.
Okay, let's begin. It's kind of hard to explain OCD to somebody who doesn't have it. When you first mention it, the first thing people usually think of is the germaphobe. But my Starbucks cup has been rotting on my bedside table for the past 3 weeks and probably has COVID 20, 21, and 22 in it. Or they'll imagine somebody who's very highly organized. But I keep all my antidepressants in a bowl mixed together in a bowl beside my bed and play Russian roulette, taking them in the dark before I sleep to see if I wake up the next morning. You see, OCD is one of those things I can only really explain in the form of stories, not words. So when I was maybe 8 to 10 years old, I had this habit of responding, maybe, maybe not, when asked if I did something. An example being, you know, I'd come home from school, and my mom would ask me, Jade, can you put the dishes away? And I'd be like, fine. So I'd go over to the kitchen, and I'd put the dishes away. Well, I'd put the dishes away, and then I'd wipe down the counter a couple of times. And then I'd go up to my room to play Moshi Monsters for 3 hours. And my mom would go into the room and ask me, hey, Jade, did you put the dishes away? I'd say, maybe, maybe not. Because in my head, the idea of there being a molecule of the porcelain plate on the counter meant that the job wasn't done. And if I said I did put the dishes away and there was a molecule of that plate on that countertop, I'd be a liar. And I had a fear of lying. So the cycle continued. Jade, did you wash your hands after you took that shit in the bathroom? Maybe. Maybe not. See, the main thing that people with OCD experience that really terrorizes them is something called intrusive thoughts. You see, intrusive thoughts are unwanted thoughts that are very, very invasive and often extremely uncomfortable. You know when you're driving over the bridge and think to yourself really quickly, oh, I could totally off-road into the river right now. Yeah, somebody without OCD might think about that thought for, I don't know, 5, 10, maybe 30 seconds. Somebody with OCD will think about that thought for up to months. First, they'll stop driving over the bridge because they're scared they're going to kill themselves. They won't go to the beach or the lake or the pool. They won't go outside when it's raining because they'll develop a fear of water, and then before they sleep, they'll put paper towels in their mouth because they're scared they're going to drown on their own saliva. It gets to a point where it completely takes over your life. Now that is actually one of the nicer examples of OCD. OCD finds it fun to terrorize you and prey on whatever you're most vulnerable or insecure about. Or it'll just be pure taboo. It's like a parasite on the brain. Speaking of being disturbed and vulnerable, I want to talk about something that happened a few years ago when my friend sent me a Snapchat video of her licking her lips in kind of a sexual way as a joke. It wasn't intended to be sexual. Obviously, it was a joke, but I developed HOCD because of it. Homosexual OCD, which is the fear of the possibility of being gay. Keep in mind that variants of OCD, like HOCD, are clinical mental problems, and I want to make that very clear. I spent all night, when these thoughts developed, doing these online Am I Gay quizzes. When they told me I was gay, I'd retake them. And when they told me I wasn't, I'd retake them. I probably took these quizzes 100 times, 200 times, a lot of times. I didn't enjoy these thoughts. They really bothered me. They bothered me because I thought I enjoyed them. But keep in mind, when I say that they bothered me, it's not that I have anything against gay people. You know, I think gay people should be able to do whatever they want, love who they want to love, and be happy. I also know that people are entitled to their own opinions, even if they're wrong. But I just feel like it wasn't me. And I was afraid of being treated differently than I already felt I was treated. I told my dad a couple of days after these thoughts developed, and he said he didn't mind, and he started reciting I Kissed a Girl lyrics by Katy Perry. But the existential crisis I was dealing with was that I didn't know whether I liked these thoughts or not, and if I did, I didn't want to. Over the span of a couple of months,
Imbert just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of Imba? Get all exclusive features for just 36 Namibian dollars a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything Imba has to offer at an unbeatable price. Imba, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
Oopsie. Over the span of a couple of months, I let the gay thoughts marinate in my brain. And eventually I decided to identify as a bisexual as a coping mechanism. I thought that my OCD would have nothing to bother me if I kind of just accepted it as a fact. I kind of told myself, well, if this is who I am, then this is who I have to be. I'm not going to live in my own thoughts, being uncomfortable with my own thoughts. My OCD didn't bother me much after that, but after I moved to university and experimented a bit, I realized that I wasn't gay, and that I mistook wanting to be somebody with wanting to be with somebody. I probably shouldn't have had to go as far as to do some of the nasty things that I did to come to that realization. The realization came, and for the sake of my mental well-being, I'm going to choose to ignore the details. I don't feel like relapsing homosexually at the moment. I have a boyfriend now, and I'm not too sure he'd be very happy about that. Or maybe he might, you know, some guys are into that. But that was the end of my HOCD. Now I like to spend my time on the OCD subreddit, talking to people who are currently dealing with HOCD and trying to make their lives a little bit less miserable. However, I got under a little bit of fire when I told somebody who was suffering to just, you know, try it and find out. But, yeah, they didn't like that very much. I'm a big believer in trying anything twice. But, yeah, they didn't really agree with me on that one. You see, people with OCD, they crave something called reassurance, which is basically where you need somebody else to tell you that you're okay. And sometimes you need to give people with OCD reassurance because it temporarily alleviates the pain caused by these intrusive thoughts. But because this reassurance is only temporary, it's only going to lead you to wanting more, which is why the only way to truly get rid of it is pulling it from its root, which means accepting it as a possibility. But sometimes accepting your intrusive thoughts as a possibility isn't always possible. OCD is as smart as you are. You and OCD both equally have the capability of thinking rationally and critically on both their sides of defense. And you need to be smarter than it in order to outsmart it. I'm going to have to deal with OCD and its attempts to torture me for the rest of my damn life. However, I've learned how to deal with it because I've learned how to separate my character from my thoughts. And that is a lot harder than you can imagine. OCD attacks your deepest and darkest fears. And my deepest and darkest fears are being a rapist, a pedophile, or gay. Not saying that any of them are even similar or on the same level of either of them. Those are just my fears, and it attacked each and every single one of them. I developed POCD shortly after HOCD when I saw a kid 4 years younger than me who I thought was quite cute. POCD is pedophilic OCD. The obsessive fear of the possibility of being a pedophile. Now, POCD, you know when you see, I want to stress actually, when I say the possibility, when you have OCD, anything is a possibility. I could think the blazer that I'm wearing is a possibility that I am. I could think that I am the shoes that I'm wearing right now. That's a possibility because your brain just tells you all these crazy things. So, I just want to get that out of the way. You know when you see a really cute kid at, I don't know, the park or the aquarium and think to yourself, oh, that kid's going to grow up and be really pretty or cute one day. I'm just going to say it hot because we all think it. We all think it. They even have a phrase for it. Oh, she's going to grow up and be a real heartbreaker one day. Yeah, my OCD took that and turned that into something unconventional and disturbing. Very disturbing. Now, pedophilic OCD is not something you can accept. From my experience, it's something that would be very difficult to come out of okay if you don't have the pre-existing skills to separate your character from your thoughts. I had disgusting thoughts and dreams about underage kids, and I didn't allow myself to look at children in public for a period of time. But the way that I got over this is because I came to the realization that I've been down this road before, and I know who I am. And who I am is not a pedophile. So thankfully, I got over that one. You might be wondering. Sorry, I'm getting a little emotional. You might be wondering where my family was in all of this. And I want to start by saying that my relationship with my family to this day is better than it's ever been. I can't express the amount of gratitude, respect, and admiration I have for my family. Because growing up with OCD made things really hard. I said things to my family that nobody should ever say. But I said these things because I was miserable. And they couldn't make me feel any better. And everyone, when they're a kid, wants to feel like their parents have the power to take all their pain away, but they don't. And I continued to say these things to them because I knew they were the only people that would let me and still love me after. Especially my mom. And I said horrible things to her because I needed comfort from her in a way that she didn't know how to give me. And it's not her fault. Even though I treated it like it was her fault for a really long time. And I really wish that I could take the things that I said back. But I can't. And I have a choice to either live the rest of my life with that guilt. Or try to become a better person out of it. Because we call something like that a sunk cost in economics. Which is where the milk has already been spilt. The words have already been said. And I can't take that back. But if I'm being honest, having to deal with OCD at such a young age has left me with this feeling of chronic loneliness. It feels like no matter where I am or who I'm around, I have this urge to prove myself to the people around me. even if they don't give me any reason or incentive to do so in the first place. And I think that's because of the inciting incident that caused my OCD. You see, people with OCD, they didn't always have it. It occurs from an inciting incident that happens from some point in their lifetime. People with OCD have a genetic predisposition for it. The OCD just kind of waits for you to become vulnerable and then it takes over you. So the incident that triggered my OCD happened when I was about 5 years old. And before I showed any symptoms of OCD, I was kind of weird. I mean, I'm still weird now, but I was also weird back then. My family nicknamed me the love thief because I couldn't handle it when anybody in my family showed affection to anybody but me. If I saw them showing affection to each other, I'd break them up like a referee. I believe I got upset once. The idea of my parents making love, not because I thought it was gross, but because I thought I was missing out. So one day, I went into my parents' bathroom while my dad was taking a shower to grab something random like a cloth or some bar of soap, and I told him, "You turn around so I don't see your pee-pee." But you know how kids, they're not really good at pronouncing things. They kind of trip on their lip, which is my way of saying they kind of skip their words and they stutter. My God, what a horrible situation to skip words in, because my dad thought I said, "Turn around so I see your pee-pee." Yeah, so my dad lost it. He started telling me something was wrong with me, screaming at me, telling me I needed to get my mindset checked out, and I don't blame him. I feel like he probably thought I was going to assault him, and I was like the opposite of, I was like a pedophile, but the roles were reversed. So basically every girl my age nowadays. But I vividly remember not saying that, and it was extremely frustrating being framed for something that I didn't do, especially so young. But I've kind of been, you know, hanging on by a durable thread ever since that happened. That was my inciting incident. As depressing as what I just said sounds, there's a silver lining to it. I think that people really need to go through those really gut-wrenching, hard times in life, and they need to be hurt, because no pain, no gain. Had I never known how miserable it felt to be lonely and mentally ill, how would I know how great it feels not to be? And I can tell you for a fact, I wouldn't be standing where I am right now in the place I am in my life, wanting to reach the sky, had I not gone through those really tough experiences as a kid. So all the people like me out there that are going through a really tough time that they won't talk about or can't talk about, just know that it doesn't end there. I am living evidence that it doesn't end there. I thought it would many times. I've wanted it to a dozen. But something in me told me that it wasn't over until I said it was over. I almost got a 23% last semester in one of my courses because I thought I withdrew from it. But apparently I didn't send the withdrawal link. This was the most important course in my transfer into business. It was economics. And I'm still losing hair from the amount of stress I went through during this. My mom told me that I should stay in arts because it's easier. And I kind of felt like she gave up on me, even if it came from a place of not wanting me to be stressed. But then again, I told myself it's not over until I say it's over. So, you know, after being depressed for a little bit, I got back up on my feet and I told myself, no, I'm going to finish this course either next semester or next year, and I'm going to show Sauder, the business school I'm trying to get into, what I really got, because it ain't 23%. I kid you not, the next day, when I went to have an appointment with one of the advisors for my accessibility program, the accessibility center, they told me I did submit that withdrawal link. Their system just didn't notify my advisor. My only reaction in that situation was, yes. And guess who just aced their econ exam the other day? Me! My dad says, if it's meant to be, it's up to me, and he's right. You can't rely on anybody or the universe or your horoscopes to get you from point A or to point B. It's up to you. You probably expect me to give you some closure to this roller coaster of a talk, but I'm not going to give you that because I didn't get that and I never will. I want to end this off with a quote my economics professor told me. He said, Jade, life is what happens when you're busy making other plans. He told me that while I was walking him to his car crying about not getting granted a concession in his class. Turns out he stole that quote from John Lennon. Anyways, that will be it from me, guys. Thank you so much for listening.
I think tonight is wonderful. I hope you guys are still out there. You guys can always call in. The number in studio is 083-288-401. We out here, we out here, we out here. We're learning.
Raise your hands. Anybody in here feel like they're lucky? Maybe you're winning your fantasy football league. Or maybe you picked the perfect schools for the March Madness brackets. Or maybe you've won money in the lottery. Good, I see some hands up. We call you the lucky few. And I'm lucky too, because I'm a one percenter. No, not the kind that you're thinking of. I'm one of the 1.2% of Americans that are living with obsessive compulsive disorder. Now, I haven't always thought that I was lucky or that I won the lottery of mental health illness. But I believe
your popular $99 combo is back at YouSave. Get 1 kilogram of each Rice King rice, top score Obacoma Super Maize Meal, Sugar King white or brown sugar, 500 grams of Pasta Polana or Pasta King, and 750 milliliter Right Brand sunflower seed oil. That's 5 essential products for only 99 Namibian dollars. You save, I save. Yes, we all save at YouSave.
That we are the sum total of all of our life experiences, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I truly do not feel that I would be the person that I am today without my long-standing struggle with obsessive-compulsive disorder. So who is the person standing here before you today? Well, I'm a wife of nearly 30 years. I have a son who is a Division I football player and a daughter who is ready to set the STEM world on fire. I have 3 college degrees, and I've helped hundreds of children and adults as a speech pathologist since 1994. I counseled thousands of U.S. Army soldiers as they transitioned out of the military into their civilian worlds. And now I work with professional athletes on a variety of skills, such as public speaking and building resumes. Now, I have devoted my entire life to helping other people live their best life. All the while, I've been struggling with an insidious mental health disorder. Now, I've done my best to keep my issues secret, and before I announced this TED Talk, less than 10 people in this whole world knew about my 30-year struggle with obsessive-compulsive disorder. Now, the reason that I'm here tonight is to bring hope to people living in the world of OCD, because you can live a life that's not dominated by OCD. I want you to see the mistakes that I've made so that you don't repeat them. I want people to see that they are stronger than they think they are. And I want you to build your house of brick and defeat the big bad wolf OCD. Now, research shows that there are 2 phases in life where OCD typically has its onset. The first phase is between the ages of 8 and 12, which is more likely to have a genetic etiology. And the second phase is between the ages of 18 and your early 20s. Now, I'm not sure which group I belong to because I distinctly remember calling my neighbor from the junior high payphone and asking her to please go to my parents' house and check to make sure that my curling iron was off. But regardless of which phase I belong to, the true manifestation of OCD did not occur in my life until I was in my 20s. Now, I knew that I had an issue with checking my curling iron. And it was causing an issue between my fiancé and I. Well, this is the deal. Diligent people, intelligent people, are diligent and concerned. What if my careless mistake led to the complete destruction of my parents' house or the apartment that I was living in? People could lose everything, get hurt, or even die. Now, as I said, it was an issue between my fiancé and I, this extreme fear that I felt about this, and it was a topic during our premarital counseling. And the counselor suggested that we role-play and switch behaviors. Now, I could see that what I was doing looked idiotic, so I worked very hard to suppress the urge to check things. And it was in my 20s when I started building my house of straw. Not long after I got my first job out of college as a speech pathologist in a local school district, my job responsibilities would completely overwhelm me. When I started my position, there were 10 speech pathologists in the district that I was in. Then 3 quit. And that left me in an overwhelming situation. All of a sudden, I was a brand new SLP and I had 75 kids on my caseload with diverse needs and diagnoses. My job completely stressed me out. Now, I started to have chest pains, so I just knew that I was having a heart attack. And I went to tell my doctor what was going on. And he said to me, "I don't think what you have requires a stress test on your heart. I believe what you're suffering from is anxiety." So he prescribed me this fabulous medication for when my anxiety and fear overtook my mind and my body. Now, I took that medication sparingly because I could handle things on my own. I also saw a couple of mental health professionals, but none of them said anything that made me want to go back. And that's how it is when you're building your house of straw. You want the quick fix. You just want your mind to be right. You're hoping that you can find a medication so you can live life and endure whatever your crazy mind throws your way. And that way you can keep things a secret. No one has to know that you're struggling. Well, as I was working in this stressful position, I started noticing that I was having these odd behaviors. I would use the computer in the school library to write my reports and the printer to print them out and shut them off and then go back to my office. But then I would go back to the library over and over to make sure that I had shut them off. And I'm embarrassed to say that I bothered the librarian and the library aide on countless occasions and asked them to please check and make sure everything was off. Now, I was working in multiple buildings, and this unbeknownst obsession was following me from building to building. And at home, I would pace the floors at night, worried because I could not get into those buildings and check to make sure everything was turned off. In the spring of 1997, my husband and I found out that we were having our first child, and we were so excited. Now, the pregnancy was smooth, and our son was born during halftime of the Orange Bowl on January 2nd, 1998. I loved being a mom, and you know what? I never worried about SIDS or any other childhood disease affecting my son, because he belonged to God and he was a gift that we were blessed with. Now, not long after my first Mother's Day, the big bad wolf OCD came and he blew my house of straw into smithereens, and I would never be the same again. Now, in the fall of 1997, I was assigned a student that had significant voice difficulties because of 2 inoperable brain tumors that were in her cerebellum. Now, when she was younger, in her elementary years, she had had radiation therapy. And the radiation therapy had adverse side effects, to include premature onset of puberty, legal blindness, and a very odd inflection and prosody to her voice. Now, there wasn't a lot of research available for me to draw from, but I did the best that I could, and I taped every session, you know, with a tape recorder. Wow. I taped all of our sessions up until I went on maternity leave, and I resumed taping right after I got back from maternity leave. Not long after Mother's Day, the parents told me that they were concerned that the cancer was back again, as evidenced by disintegrating speech patterns. I was shocked. I had not noticed any worsening of her speech. Now, improvement was hard to achieve and measure, but I had been vigilant, and I had taped every session. Well, the appointment was set for mid-June, and I was having a hard time concentrating on anything else besides this appointment. I would go to work and complete my work as best that I could, and when I would get done with my workday, I would be at home pacing the floors, analyzing those tapes over and over again. I was in agony. I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. It was a horrible feeling. Well, the night of the appointment with the doctors, after discussing their concerns with their doctors at the children's hospital where she'd been treated previously, the doctors refused to run a CAT scan. They said that what the parents were seeing were the continued residual effects of radiation therapy. So I was right. I was vindicated. And nobody was going to die due to my ineptitude. It should have been a done deal. It was just a set of judicious parents concerned about the well-being of their child. But I was too far gone. I couldn't turn the obsession off in my head. I ended up quitting my job because I lived in extreme fear of what the next school year would bring for me. What rare case that I would encounter. Now, I later found out that quitting my job was an avoidance behavior demonstrated by many people with obsessive compulsive disorder. Now, here's what I'd like to tell you, that about a month after that parent took their child to the doctor, that everything was smooth and I was happy and everything was coming up roses. But here's the truth. Because if everything was great after a month, that would make for a very short story. The truth of the matter is, it took me a year to get to the point where I could pick up sticks to build my house of sticks. After about a year, things were going smoothly. My husband was working and building a business out of town. I loved being a mom, and I was feeling pretty good. And God worked in a miraculous fashion, and I got the job of my dreams. I was working for the U.S. military in out-processing. I was a career counselor for U.S. Army soldiers as they transitioned out of the military into their civilian world. Now, this job was great. This job allowed me to use my creativity, and it let me do what I love doing the most, which is help people. It was a great setting, and everyone I worked with was retired military, and most of them combat veterans. That I started to become more self-aware, and I could see that some of the things that I were feeling probably weren't right. I was extremely anxious, always worried. I never slept through the night, and I was having a very hard time suppressing the urge to check things. I attribute all of this to anxiety. The thought of it being anything else besides anxiety never crossed my mind. Well, I went to my doctor and I said, you know, is there any relief available for me? Because I do not want my son growing up seeing how I'm acting. My doctor prescribed me this fabulous medication. And when I was on it, I had no worries. In fact, I could be on a life raft in the middle of the ocean, surrounded by sharks, and still remain calm. Now, I think I took this medication a year or two. And it was the best I'd ever felt in my life. When our son was 4 years of age, we decided that we wanted to grow our family, and that meant no meds. So I quit cold turkey. Well, that was a disaster. I started having these lightning zaps go through my head, and I had to go to my doctor and admit what I had done. He worked with me through a treatment program so that I could get over the medication that I was taking. And I later found out that that medication is rarely prescribed anymore because of the difficulty getting off of it. Now, over the course of the next 2 years, my husband and I, we had 3 miscarriages. But I thought I handled it pragmatically. I mean, everyone experiences loss. I thought it was our turn statistically. And after the 3rd miscarriage, we found out that I had a very rare blood clotting disorder called antiphospholipid syndrome that only affected me while I was pregnant. Now, the treatment consisted of injecting myself twice daily with heparin. Did I say that I hate needles? So, I would go to my doctor's office before work, when my husband was out of town working, and in the evenings I would have friends help me with my injections. Well, let's just say that the cocktail of pregnancy hormones and my still undiagnosed OCD made for a lethal combination. I was bombarded with these intrusive thoughts, obsessions, and acting on all my these compulsions. It was terrible. I would have to drive around the block multiple times to make sure that I shut my garage door. And then I had this horrible feeling in my gut.
Litabazende kize imba izwezipiri. Luekerize mikwaye nguyencha kukona kunolofaza kwa nkufisa hamo chualo ni mata amska vwana kare. Kala mituksirize kuvwana msevelezo wa imba ye, mufumane lisevelezo zezwezipiri ze kakulifafela mashering alika na $36 million kakweli. Kapa kamikwaye kutesifafasi ye tatama, 5% machipisa hamungo tisari kwerize talu, 10% machipisa hamungo tisari kwerize sirela, 25% machipisa hamungo tisari kwerize lishumiperi. Muketeri kwerize zo movata kuri mukone kala ku ikola zendezo imba imiswalezi fama chipisa imba tokubukanira fasi kaufela mwipe kwali sebelezo za imba kachenu kuri mukone ku ikola zende kaufela.
Went over a bump in the road and I thought that I had killed someone, so I had to drive around the block and come back and make sure that everything was okay. And then I absolutely couldn't leave my office without checking the 20 or so computers in our lab. And what's worse is I had to have another adult walk around with me to make sure they were off. You see, I was working in one of the most important buildings on a military installation. And I was scared to death that if I had a careless mistake, the building could be burned down. And a person that was a fireman person could possibly get hurt, and all these materials, sensitive items, would be lost. Oh my God, I was going crazy, and the whole world was watching. I just couldn't turn these things off in my head. So one evening, I decided to make some banana bars with cream cheese frosting, because, you know, doing things for other people makes you feel better. And I delivered my treats to all the elderly folks in my neighborhood. The next morning, I woke up with a huge panic attack. I was just sure that the cream cheese not being refrigerated was going to lead to deadly food poisoning. Oh my God, I was killing all the old people. I had to go to these little ladies in the neighborhood and tell them what I thought I had done. And they assured me that the sugar offset the dairy and the cream cheese. And you know what? Nobody got sick and nobody died from my banana bars. But I couldn't trust my brain. And it was around this time that Andrea Yates drowned her 5 precious children. And in my altered state of mind, I was afraid that I had the same problem. My husband was busy building a company 2 hours away. And I refused to stay at my own home with my 4-year-old son at night because I couldn't trust my brain. So I hired our teenage babysitter to sleep on my couch for all the times that I was alone. I distinctly remember sitting on my couch thinking, life is not worth living. Now, I had no plans to kill myself, but I did not want to be alive. I couldn't take my mind anymore. Well, since I was going to my doctor every morning for my shots before I would go to work, I was starting to tell him things, and I was telling him how I was feeling. And one day, he said to me, "I believe that your OCD is what's causing your anxiety." And there it was. I was finally correctly diagnosed. Now, my doctor consulted with my maternal fetal medicine and my OBGYN, and they decided that medication for me far outweighed any dangerous effects to my unborn baby girl. The doctor started naming medications that I could start taking, and I said to him, "No way." I said, "Those drugs sound like medications only freaks take." I was cool. I mean, I hid my embarrassing behavior really well, I thought. And what if one of my cool friends found out about this medication that I was taking? Who was I kidding? How many times did I embarrass myself by acting on my compulsions? And I'm not sure how he did it, but he convinced me to take these medications. So by now, my house of sticks had been blown to pixie dust by the big bad wolf OCD. Now, it took weeks and months for the medication to start taking effect, but when it did, gloriously, my life changed. When OCD wasn't overpowering my life on a daily basis, I could cope. You know what? The sun started shining again, and chocolate started tasting good, and the smell of roses was intoxicating. When our daughter was 4 months old, we made a big leap of faith, and we moved 2 hours out of our comfort zone. We left our home, and we moved to the big city. We found our home, our forever home, in a cul-de-sac surrounded by wonderful people. And eventually, I got a position as a speech pathologist in the local school district. Now, that was very scary because I had quit my job before, and I was really worried that a rare case would trigger my OCD. But now was the time to start building my house of brick. Every day that I didn't succumb to OCD was another brick in my house. And in time, it became the norm not to be bombarded with obtrusive thoughts, obsessions, and my compulsions. I was an overcomer. And sometimes I would walk into work and I would say to myself, "If you only knew what I had overcome just to be here today." Now, I would be remiss if I didn't tell you that at some points, my OCD is triggered by stress. And in fact, sometimes whole sections of the bricks in my house fall. But here's the good news. It doesn't stay that way. I no longer succumb to all of the issues that OCD brought on me. Now, if you have heard these things, if anything rings true to you, I encourage you to build your house of brick. And let's start tonight. Now, when I think about building a house, I think about clearing the land. And clearing the land consists of absolution. Give yourself and those in your environment absolution. OCD is a chemical imbalance, and it's no one's fault. Then you need to lay the foundation. And the foundation consists of self-love. Accept yourself for who you are, and let go of the self-loathing and the embarrassment caused by acting on your compulsions. Now, the walls of your house, they'll be framed with help from professionals, such as a medical doctor or a psychiatrist, and they can guide you in your treatment. Then your house, the roof will stand tall, protecting you as you work your way through treatment. Then, day by day, as you overcome your OCD, you can add brick to your house. And pretty soon, your house will be impregnable. And nothing that the big bad wolf OCD blows your way will make it fall.
Beautiful, 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 beautiful stories that we have heard there from people's experiences. If anything is remotely relatable to you, please have it checked out. Have it checked out and have it seen so that the experts, you know, the experts, they can tell you, which I know, this is what's up and this is what's not up. And then we can do exactly that. So good evening to you, my beloveds. My name is the Matriarch and we are fast approaching the end of our show this evening. But before that, and dear to a peepindi.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, and I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Simon, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Lipurane ngeno wapumbwa Eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe utete opoye ekukulile. Oshafa fana nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshuala. Onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka. Okupitira oipindi konu konda doi inawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka. Opone ushendi fenawa nokumona oijabo ili nawa. Ninge pata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM. Onora itatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ileko berewa vera hetatu natu bali o hetatu matatu o mafilane Eagle FM the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any of its staff.
Alrighty. Good evening. Good evening. So, ladies and gentlemen, on this lovely evening, I hope that, we have touched base on the conversation around OCD and intrusive thoughts and when to seek help. And also, if you have experienced any of the symptoms, any of the signs that have been discussed here tonight,
There are ways to cope. And if then you don't cope, then you should see somebody. But recognize and label them. Identify the thoughts as an intrusive thought. Remind yourself that it is just a thought, not a reflection of your character. Number two, avoid fighting them. Trying to suppress or fight the thought often makes it stronger. Mm-hmm. Let it just flee, okay? And number three is practice mindfulness. Techniques like mindful meditation can help you observe the thoughts without judgment and let it pass. And last but not least, seek professional help. Therapists like cognitive behavioral therapists, CBT, can be very effective for managing intrusive thoughts. So, ladies and gentlemen, that was all she wrote for this evening. That was all she said. That was the end of it. That was au revoir for us. And we are bidding you farewell this evening with a bang. We are bidding you farewell because, hey, wazala. So before any of that, I say bye-bye. And I'll see you again tomorrow. And in case, right? In case you were having one of those days where you're like, oh, I really, really, really miss the matriarch. Then you are in luck. Then you are in luck. Alrighty. Bye-bye.